Committee and onto full finance. I reserve the right to pull it back into our omnibus bill, depending on what is happening with this bill in the House, to make sure that we have all options available. But we are planning to send the bill and have it travel on its own. So with that, Senator Pappas, how do you want to go ahead and review the fiscal note? You want somebody in the department to do that?
Well, I think our fiscal staff could do that for us.
Madam Chair, I wasn't involved in preparing it.
Well,
but I can,
we could have the Office of Higher Education could do it as well.
Yep.
That would be fine.
Yep. Right. Let's call on the Office of Higher Ed who prepared it. Is Tricia available? Okay. The expert is coming to the table.
Megan Fitzgibbon from the Office of Higher Education. I was involved in the fiscal note process. We helped, along with the University of Minnesota and Minsky, to formulate some estimates for the costs involved in the bill. The first, you can, where we started, and you can see the results of it on, it looks like page 4 of the fiscal note. We used a method that was used by the state of Maryland in determining their cost of their version of the DREAM Act, in determining the impact on enrollment of public institutions, and then we essentially kind of formulated it so that it was in the version or in a way that would reflect the population of undocumented immigrants in Minnesota as opposed to the way it is in Maryland or Texas or California. And then we ended up with a total impact or an estimated impact of approximately 751 students at any time in the future in any year. So this is essentially saying we don't really assume that's going to happen next year, but that at any point in time in the future it would be a total of 751 students. Then, based on how the enrollments are spread across the different kinds of institutions, post-secondary institutions we have in Minnesota, we took that 751 and divided amongst those who are enrolled as undergraduates and graduate students and then in each sector. And then the University of Minnesota and Minsky used those numbers in order to determine their institutional costs. So as for the impact on state grant, we assumed of those 751 students, approximately half would qualify for a state grant. And that actually doesn't, we don't necessarily assume exactly half, but by using a 50%, we take into account the level of enrollment of students, those who might be enrolled for fewer credits, and then where they're enrolled, whether it's a higher cost institution or a lower cost institution. And then that helped us determine the impact of the on the state grant program, which for state grant spending was approximately, what did we come up with here? 539,000 each year, almost 1.1 per biennium.
Ms. Fitzgibbons, I had a conversation with Tricia Grimes previously, and so I just wanted the members to understand what I'm thinking with regard to the state grant program, because I do see it differently than what you've got recorded in this fiscal note. So this fiscal note goes ahead and puts the cost of those students being eligible in on this record. But I said, for example, assume that in the district that I represent, which is Minnetonka and Plymouth, assume in the northern part of Plymouth there's a huge new development, and all of a sudden we have an influx of students that qualify for the state grant. I wouldn't carry a fiscal note on that new development because we only have a certain amount of money available for the state grant, and so it's going to serve as money's available. So, in fact, should this bill end up in the omnibus bill, we aren't going to increase our state grant program. This is going to be an equal opportunity for all eligible. And so I do reject that notion, and I wouldn't carry that in my bill.
The one thing that we do have in here from the office, Madam Chair, for the Office of Higher Education is a one-time appropriation or one-time cost of $100,000 for administrative costs just to establish the system.
Yes.
That we would that the office would need to have in order to collect information and then award aid based on that.
Ms. Fitzgibbons, I would carry that in my bill. Okay. Because I understand that. You have to program it. You have to create a new FAFSA. There's all sorts of different things. And I would like to say on the record how much I appreciate the University of Minnesota and MinSCU for not knowing really how this affects them, but to say that they are going to, in fact, incorporate the costs as a matter of everyday course. And so we greatly appreciate that, and we appreciate all the work that OHE has done on this. Senator?
With that, Madam Chair, I would just take questions. I don't have any testifiers. I didn't plan to repeat the hearing that we've already had generously in your committee.
Thank you.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, maybe we could just get a little more explanation of the first page so that we understand better where the numbers came from, given that we just received a 13-page fiscal note 2 minutes or 3 minutes ago. And if we could get a little bit better explanation of this first page so that we know where those numbers came from. I mean, I understand you explained the formula and how you came to them, but I'm just, because there's the 639 and if you could just explain it, I appreciate
Madam Chair, Senator, one thing that is different about the first page, and I'm not a representative of MMB, but sometimes it can be confusing what the first page is as opposed to the things that are in the rest of the fiscal note. But what is showing here, is, at least for the Office of Higher Ed at the top, the 639, is the impact that we're estimating on state grant. And then the $100,000 that we would estimate for the cost for administrative in the first year. And then we're also indicating in here as a, you don't see the 50, but there is a $50,000 year FTE or employment or administrative costs, which our agency has chosen to, has indicated on our part that we would absorb that that administrative costs. You would see that on the first page of the Office of Higher Ed section of the fiscal note, but you don't see it here. Then for MinSCU, and one thing that's different on the front here is that MinSCU is showing both a net expenditure of the $2.5 million each year and a net revenue of $2.571, and that then negates itself. It zeroes itself out. And then the University of Minnesota's actually shows up as a zero on the front page here because within their portion of the fiscal note, they're noting I think it's $175,000 each year, but they're also showing that the agency or the University of Minnesota can absorb those costs or those that estimated change in expenditures.
Any other questions on the fiscal note?
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer the A7 amendment. And I'll just talk about it very briefly while it's being handed out. Members, this goes to the...
I have it.
I know you have it.
I mean, I'm telling the page. Sorry.
Oh.
So he doesn't run up here. I apologize.
Sorry, Madam President. I'm still nervous up here, so please forgive me.
Senator Pratt, you're doing great.
So what this does is when we saw this in policy, we talked about the fact that we wanted students to be moving down a path of citizenship or a path of legal status. And what this would do is require documentation that the student comply with selective service registration requirements.
Very good. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt discussed this with me, and I don't have a problem with it because I think that he's right. We're trying to move these students toward legal status, and if they were legal, the men would have to comply with selective service registration requirements. So I don't see a problem with it.
Very good. So Anybody else want to comment on that? I, too, support it. Senator Pratt had mentioned it to me, and I thought it was a good amendment. So Senator Pratt moves to amend Senate file number 723 as put forward. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I want to help you with your bill. I am compelled by the stories that I've heard from the students of our Minnesota schools that want to go to college. And I want to help them. I want to help you pass your bill because I appreciate the work ethic that our students have invested in education. They've worked very hard, from the stories I've heard, to build a new life here. And that makes me very proud of all of them and encouraged for our future. But I think that there are some practical applications that we have to engage in. And I think Senator Pratt's effort is a good one that helps us identify those that are really working through a process. And I think that was where I thought there was some room for improvement. I apologize for not having had a chance to talk with you about this beforehand, but sometimes the most enlightened thought comes after you think, I'm going to vote no. And I thought, wait a minute, I don't want to vote no. I want to vote yes. So in that spirit, I would offer the A-10 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, while that's being passed out, I just wanted to comment a little bit on what Senator Ortman is saying and point out in the bill on line 1.17 and 1.18, it does require the student, it says that the student has to file an application to legalize the student's immigration status or will file an application at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so. So we are really encouraging students to move toward legality as soon as it's available.
Well, and Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ortman.
I agree. The A-10 amendment was drafted before I talked to Senator Pratt about his A-7 amendment, and I think it should be either or. And so I'm going to offer an oral amendment so that we get the gist of this properly. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the word or to be added on line 1.2 just before on the A-10. And council may be able to provide,
Madam Chair,
advice.
Council, Mr. Fuller.
If you look at the Pratt A7 amendment, he's added the word "and" there. So we can do one of two things. Let's fix it. We actually have to change. I don't think we can fix it because we've adopted his amendment. I think you should just instruct us to add an or in the proper spot in the engrossing process.
That's fine.
Otherwise, we'd have to reconsider his amendment, if you'd like to do that.
So, Madam Chair, if the A-10 is adopted, it would be with that or provision, and it is my hope that it would be offered with that.
Yep. I think that's sufficient that should this be adopted, that we'll instruct staff to include the or at the appropriate spot. Mr. Fuller.
Maybe what we can do is since Senator Pratt's amendment's part of the bill now, we can just say that becomes an or. She'll move to make that an or, and then her amendment will work.
And Mr. Fuller, I think we should wait to see if it's adopted first.
This is the amendment as proposed.
Yes. Gotcha.
And, Madam Chair, it's intended with the or as an alternative. And, okay. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, what the A-10 would accomplish, I believe, is to follow on what's going to happen, I believe, at the federal level. I absolutely believe that in April or May of 2013 this year, our federal government is going to be passing the pathway to citizenship. I believe that they will. And I think that what we want to do is be proactive but not premature and say that if you register for the Selective Service or you can document your status through one of the federal agencies, then you qualify for the in-state tuition. I think it's an either-or. You shouldn't have to file for the Selective Service. That's one way. But another way would be to get verification from the INS or federal immigration authorities that you have filed proper paperwork. I think it should be either or, and I hope that you would accept it in the spirit that it's offered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ortman, if we have a federal process, if a federal process exists for a student to obtain lawful immigration status, we wouldn't be talking about this. That means what it means when you say the federal process exists to obtain lawful immigration, that means that people will apply for an immigration status in this country and they can go to work, they can go to study, and they can do everything they want, just like you and me. So having that provision in there is actually a problem for this bill. Plus, we don't need it. If that happens, you don't need to have this bill. That's just going to automatically happen. Why would you mention if a person has legal status in this country, then you can do whatever a person with a legal status can do in this country? There's no reason to state that. Imagine if we had to state in state legislation everything that is at the federal level. It just makes no difference. So I am questioning the purpose of having that very strong statement in this legislation when Senator Pratt already put an amendment that actually is, you know, if that's the preference of this committee, to require that the student, have documentation to file for application for lawful immigration status. That's different. But I don't see the reason for the first part of your amendment.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair. The intention of Senate File 723, and correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Pappas, is to grant in-state tuition rates to students that currently are undocumented. And what I'm saying is it's not workable in the way it's currently drafted in 723 with an affidavit. And so I've been trying, as Senator Pratt has been trying, to find ways that students can qualify and verify that they are working towards permanent legal status here, so that they can make the in-state tuition available to themselves. They're trying to qualify. And I agree, let's find a process that we all can agree on that they can verify and qualify for in-state tuition.
Madam Chair. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I see just a couple. I understand your intention, Senator Ortman, and I appreciate it. And that was the purpose of the language on 1719. which actually was proposed by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce when we did this bill a couple years ago. Senator Pratt's language says that you have to document that you've complied with selective service registration requirements, which works for the boys. And then it's an or, you a process must exist. So you're really kind of leaving the girls in limbo because they can't apply for selective service requirements because they're girls. And there is no federal process that exists currently. And I wish I felt as optimistic as you did about May and June or May and April, but I've been working on this bill for like a decade. And every year we hope that we're going to have immigration reform. And in the discussions in Washington, I've not read of any discussion about anything to do with the DREAM Act. It's all about guest workers and how we're going to accommodate guest workers or low-wage workers in the workforce. So I don't know if they're even talking about educational opportunities for undocumented kids in Washington.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
That would be our role in the state of Minnesota to say what are the educational opportunities for these folks. And I want to say yes, we want to grant them in-state tuition once they've documented that they are following the legal process for becoming legal residents and hopefully ultimately citizenship. And that's what I'm trying to encourage. And so I think whether it's the bill that passes in hopefully April or May, or whether the Department of Homeland Security or INS pass some process for registering, I think that's a good way to verify that these students are applying for a different legal status and should be granted and qualified for in-state tuition. It's a practical approach to what is, I think, an operability problem with your bill, which is you've currently got, Senator Pappas, a process by which a student files an affidavit that they're currently have applied or they will in the future, and that's the part I have a difficult time with because there's no way to verify that they've actually done that.
Senator Pappas, I have a question. And I, too, wondered when we heard the bill the last time, and I remember some folks from the Office of Higher Ed addressed this, but if you could clarify, what is the group that is the not yet ready, the ones who aren't yet eligible to file for it? Is it that they haven't reached a certain age yet? You know, so your bill says, in the case of a student without lawful immigration status, the filing of an affidavit with the institution of higher education stating that the student has filed an application or, and this is the question here, or will file an application at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so. What does that earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so really mean?
Well, Madam Chair, it's because we don't know what the federal process is going to be, the language is necessarily a little vague. If we had an idea of what the federal process is going to be, and I think that Senator Ortman's language is more specific, where she talks about documentation from federal immigration authorities that the student has filed an application. And that would help with the first part of it if there was a process. But it doesn't help if nothing passes this spring and there is no process. But we want them to follow the process. That's what we're trying to get them to do. But we don't want to leave them in the lurch if there is no process, because we want them to still be able to begin college. But say that as soon as a process is set in place, then you have to file for legal status. And that's the language I'm trying to get.
Senator Ortman, I too don't want to penalize the girls. That's what really bothers me about it, because the process whereby Senator Pratt's identified does handle the young men. But what do you – oh, Mr. Fuller has a
– Madam Chair, I think that it only requires – Senator Pratt amendment requires you to satisfy your obligation. If you don't have one, you've satisfied it. So it only applies to people who have obligations. So there's not a distinguish between the sexes, I understand.
But Madam Chair and Mr. Fuller, you are saying or there. So you satisfy your selective service obligation or you file for legal status, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I'm just talking about the Senator Pratt Amendment. It does not exclude the opportunity for a female to get resident tuition status just because they don't have to file for selective service. If they don't have to file, they don't have to file. They've complied with their selective service obligation by not filing. And the end and an or is a different issue.
Right. And yes. I'm trying to understand the
Yeah, law. Mr. Fuller, so that was my concern is if we added on Senator Ortman's provision, but I hear you, that it's we're still the problem is with the – Senator Ortman, do you have a
– Madam Chair, the concern I have with the bill right now is that it's premature, that we don't know what the federal government is going to do. I believe they will put a process in place that may create a waiting period. You, I think, recognize the fact that there is no way for these students right now, most of them, to get some kind of federal documentation. And I believe that should be a condition, even though it might create a waiting period, but I think it should be a condition for this in-state residency or residence for tuition. And I do believe that it's coming. I believe these folks in this room and the advocates all across the country have been doing a very good job of making this change inevitable. I think it's great. But I think it's still a problematic in the bill as you have it that we don't have a workable plan for documenting these folks and verifying that they're part of a process to become legal and or citizens.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, just a point of information, getting back to the end and or. If you put in or, then you would not have to satisfy your selective service obligation if you satisfied the other disjunctive phrase. So one or the other would become a nullity. Mm-hmm. So,
Senator Sharon.
How often, Senator Pappas, let's see, how can I ask you this question? How often, I'll back up. Once a person is determined under this to be eligible for resident tuition, is that it forever, or is that something that is done annually when you're paying your tuition? In terms of this issue that's being discussed about whether or not a process will or will not be passed at the federal level that allows for a process for legalization of status. If that doesn't pass, and we are with language that says at its when earliest opportunity. How is the process for being allowed resident tuition accomplished? Is that done one time, or is that a periodic review where you could catch and say somebody has actually followed through with this earliest opportunity issue?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I think we'd have to talk to admission officials at the colleges to, I'm sure they would have to figure out a process for this. But I'm not familiar with, if other states have this language, what they've done.
I think, members, what we're dealing with is we do want the students to comply with our intention to file at the earliest opportunity that they're eligible to do so. But many of us around this table want to allow them access while the federal government is working all this out. And so I think our concern, Senator Ortman, is that if we adopt this provision, then students next fall, if they haven't worked this out, who have the promise and the intention to file, will have to wait, put their college education on hold while the federal government figures it out.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, they've been waiting a decade.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of them will not go to college now because if they don't feel like they can still do that. We don't want to make the current crop of high school graduates wait another decade.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, respectfully,
and
they can still get to their college education through the outstate rates. It's not they're being precluded. There are lots of Minnesota students that also would like to qualify for college but have to wait because they have to raise money or whatever. I mean, I'm not insensitive to the waiting period, but I believe it's coming. But I think our system in Minnesota should operate well with the federal government. And this is a federal issue ultimately. Ultimately, the immigration status and the legal status of residents across the United States is federal. And I think we're asking to get ahead of the federal government here. And I'm not comfortable with that because even in your bill, you're asking these students to verify that they are part of a process to become legal residents and or citizens. And I agree with that, but I think there needs to be a practical approach in your bill that gets us all in that same place. And I think you'd have a lot of bipartisan support if you would support a position like this that allows us to verify that these students not only have the intention but have actually done something about filing with the federal government.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'm certainly willing to work with Senator Ortman to tighten up the language that that if there is a process that they would use to document. But I agree with the chairwoman that right now there is not a process, and we don't know that there's going to be a process. And 14 other states have moved ahead and said that we're not going to wait forever for the federal government. We want to get these kids in college and get them educated. And so I would, at this point, I would ask the committee to reject the A-10 amendment, not precluding the opportunity that Senator Ortman and I couldn't have further discussions on this to see if we can come up with an agreement.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on, actually, on the question that you had, Madam Chair, because I don't know that we got a firm answer on it, and I don't know if this is for Senator Pappas or Council, but what would the result be if we eliminated the language on line 1.18 and 1.19 that says, or will file an application at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so? So my question to Council is, what would the result be if we eliminated that? And then I'll have a follow-up question, and it's basically the same question you had, Madam Chair. Who would fall into that category? Or will file an application at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so?
Well, I'll start, Madam Chair. I am not aware of any process whereby a student can file an application to legalize their status. So right now, there no process exists. But we're sending the message that once a process exists, we expect students to do that. And, you know, and that's the language I said that we could tighten up.
So, for example, Senator Pappas and Senator Claussen, we could put some language in saying upon a process, upon the existence of a process, the They must demonstrate they have filed within 30 days to retain eligibility or something like that.
Madam
right.
Chair, that's what Senator my Ortman. Amendment does.
Well, it does. I don't read it that way, Senator Ortman, because to me it looks like if the way that I just said it, the student's eligible even if the process doesn't exist, whereas I'm saying the minute the process does exist, they have to file. But they're eligible until that process exists right. with the enactment of this bill.
Right. She's saying that a federal process must exist for the student to apply, and it doesn't exist. She would have to wait.
Well, Madam Chair, it's only through Senator Pappas's reading of her language mm-hmm. that these students would have to apply once a federal process exists. That's not actually in your bill right now.
Madam Chair, that's the intent of 118 and 119. They will file an application at the earliest opportunity the student is eligible to do so. That's the intent of that.
And Senator Pappas, counsel would be happy to help us with language that fulfills that, but I want to give Senator Claussen a chance to speak before they offer that. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would vote no on this amendment, and here's why. First of all, I don't think we can vote on something we don't know if or if not it's going to happen at the federal level. I think that's we're being subjective in doing that. And then I think this whole thing is really a catch-22 for students. First of all, they must present documentation, but if there's no process to present documentation, they can't file. It's a catch-22 for them, and it's just a runaround. So I am voting no.
Thank you. I think that – go ahead, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope we're working on – I think there is a solution here to what Senator Ortman is pointing out, and she's right to do so, is putting some kind of definite time period that requires that you are working through this process once it becomes available. I hope that's what Senator Ortman is working on right now, because I definitely support a provision like that.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, and Senator Pappas, Senator Peterson, I'd like to think that there's a way to craft this language that grandfathers in the students now, but once a federal process exists, then they are barred from participating unless and until they apply and can verify their new status. So then you've got a gap, but an opportunity to make this coexistent with a federal program once that becomes operable.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this has been a very productive conversation. And what I'm hearing Senator Ortman express isn't what, you know, is in the A-10. And so I was prepared to vote against the A-10, but I think it'd be okay. And I think it sounded like Senator Pappas is all right with tightening that up to make sure, as long as we don't preclude kids graduating today
right.
from being able to, you know, follow their dreams. We need to make sure that that's preserved, but that as soon as a federal program does arrive, they really are required to, more than just an affidavit that they signed today, there actually is some more teeth to make sure that they follow up on what they said they would do and do it. And I think that is a reasonable ask, and if it buys bipartisan support, I think we should, you know, encourage counsel to help us craft that. I hope we're close, and I think that could really work. And
I think counsel believes they have something. Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, members, I think we start with the Senator Pratt amendment, and my understanding was that his intent was that in all events there had to be selective service compliance. So you'd add the word and then you would take basically the entire A-10 amendment, but you would change it. And after end, you would – well, the end is already in there. You would say, if a federal process exists for the student to obtain lawful immigration status, the student must present the – and it reads the rest of the sentence. So I don't know.
Madam Chair, could you have –
could you read the rest of it? Right.
Mr. Fuller.
What it would say.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, on your A-10 amendment, the only changes would be
A-10.
On line 2, before insert if – if a federal process, delete must, make exist on line 3, plural, exists for the student to obtain lawful immigration status, delete and, the student must present the higher education institution with documentation from federal immigration authorities that the student has filed an application to obtain lawful immigration status. And then delete the other line. So.
And Mr. Fuller, the fact that a student may have already been given that in-state tuition before the process exists, is there some way to have language that gives them a time frame to have to come back to demonstrate that they've now complied?
Madam Chair, I'm not following that question.
Well, I guess maybe I've thought that through because they have to the next year come back anyway.
And that was why I was asking, is this something that's reviewed on an annual basis? Because if that was the case, then you would pick this up and say, there is a process in place now, but you haven't filed, and we don't have a copy of your filing of the affidavit. So,
Mr. Fuller?
You know, I think Senator Ortman has a point, and if we could figure out a way to add that component to it.
And we may need Ms. Grimes to come to the table to answer that question about the annual. But Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, this is a relationship between the school and the student.
Yeah,
so the student school will get a bill from the institution each year. And their authorization, as the law now stands probably, would be that they could only get resident tuition if they complied with the law. And then, so if this process did exist, I don't think they're grandfathered in to forever ignore the law. It's a fairly fine point. I think if we start at this juncture in the meeting trying to determine that issue, we might bury ourselves in minutiae.
And actually,
I think it works itself out.
I think it does, and I think we've thought that through because I think we can direct the institutions to comply with the intent of the law. So I think we're probably good.
It sounds, Madam Chair, it sounds like there's a consensus.
I guess Senator Klassen may have something.
Just one quick point. In line 1.18, if you would add, I'm just going to read it, application to legalize the student's immigration status or will file an application within 30 days when the student is eligible to do so, does that get at what people are looking for? You're setting an expectation that they will file within a certain time limit once that process becomes clear?
I think we're deleting that language. Right. So we're going with the A10. So I'm not sure if it would fit in the A10.
I'm offering another option is what I'm saying.
Okay.
This amendment is on the floor. Right. So Senator Ortman would have to say she was willing to put that aside. So I think
his name is John Cutter.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I want the specificity of reference to the federal immigration authorities here. And I do think that the council's recommendations are good ones, and I'd like to incorporate them into the A-10 before we vote on the amendment, Madam Chair.
Very good. So Senator Ortman inserts if before A on line 1.2, deletes must on line 1.3, adds an S to exist on line 1.2. Three deletes and.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Just a little bit on the 30-day requirement. This gentleman is an immigration lawyer and could maybe comment on the kind of the difficulty of that.
And Senator Pappas, we didn't. We actually didn't put it in. We aren't doing it, so we don't need that. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
I'll just go
away. Okay.
So let's
read
the language again.
So the amendment reads, if a federal process exists for the student to obtain lawful immigration status, the student must present the higher education institution with documentation from federal immigration authorities that the student has filed an application to obtain lawful immigration status.
And
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, and just for clarification and confirmation, maybe this would be a one-time event. I mean, once the federal process exists, it exists, and our higher ed institutions would say, okay, now look, everyone who came in under this, you need to step forward. And if you don't, you know, so it's a one-time shot, and it should be, I think, fairly manageable at that point, particularly with that. It's not a phased-in approach or anything. I mean, all of a sudden, there will be a process available for people to apply, and we do want them to pursue that. And that was attempted to be reflected in the original bill, and I think this clarifies it in a productive and manageable manner.
Very good. So with that, Senator Ortman renews her motion as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any other discussion? I think we're – oh, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
don't push your luck.
I know. I'm a freshman. I'm supposed to press my luck. I'd like to offer the A8 amendment, and I'll let that get passed out here. Madam Chair, the A8 amendment essentially says that a student must be a United States citizen or a permanent resident of the United States to be eligible for financial aid.
Right.
We've been talking a lot about in-state tuition.
That's a good point.
And I think that's one of the questions. The other question is whether or not we allow state financial aid resources to be made available. And I think, as you correctly identified, we're not talking about raising the pool or the amount. What it does is it creates more competition for those scarce resources among those who are already qualified. What I hope is that the bill, without financial aid, opens the door for admission, opens the door to make it more financially viable. Students would still qualify for private scholarships and grants. They just would not be, but since they don't qualify under FAFSA and under Pell, they would not be eligible for the state grant as well, preserving those resources for those that currently qualify.
And Senator Pratt, and I'll let Senator Pappas speak first, and then I go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Senator Pratt and I did discuss this, but I do feel that it is difficult. It'll be difficult for these students to go to college, even with in-state tuition of $8,000, like for a Minsky institution, much more for the university. And that they are students that we want to go to college, and they are low-income students by and large. They've gone to a Minnesota high school. They've grown up in Minnesota. They consider themselves Minnesota. And I think we really should treat them just like all other students. And that would be the goal, as we have an immigration process that works for them. And so I don't think it's fair to exclude them from being eligible for the state grant.
And Senator Pappas, I strongly agree with you on this one. I think that the purpose of this bill is about opening a door for equal opportunity for all. And so I wasn't willing to increase the state grant pool and say these new eligible people would have priority or preference and all be in, but rather it's a competitive process and there's a formula that exists to determine how much folks get. And if we say they're eligible, then by gosh, they're eligible. And I don't want people to have like, you're this class, you're that class, but in fact, you're in. So, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just go back from our previous discussions on this issue. This is workforce development. These are our, you know, these should be our most competitive and able workers for the future. We're going to need top talent in our state as we move forward and look at some demographic changes. And I think we need to look at all Minnesotans for that resource. Thank you.
So can we vote, or do you want to
go ahead? Well, you know, just to address some of those issues, I'm trying to open the doors, right, and remove the barriers to admission. Once immigration reform is passed, these folks will be documented. They'll qualify under the same way that they do today. What we're saying is that there is a difference, though, right? And while we may not want there to be a difference, there is, and we've got new students now competing for very scarce resources that we're already hearing are underfunded and are underavailable to the students that need them today that already qualify. It would require the state to implement basically its own FAFSA process. So there's currently a federal form. There's currently a federal process that feeds into the state grant program. They wouldn't qualify under that, so then we'd have a secondary process. Whether it's preferential or not, they're already being treated differently once they go through that process. So, Senator Kent, I would say that there is differences already. We can't get around those differences. Maintaining the resources for the students that already qualify But yet opening the opportunity and the admission opportunities for those students is and the in-state tuition, which is how we continually talk about this without necessarily talking about the real cost driver, which is the grant program.
Okay. So, Senator Sharon?
I just want to make sure I'm clear about this. Although I don't think I'll support the amendment, I just want to make sure I understand that in Senator Pappas, as it relates to the grant, we have a certain finite amount of money that's defined for the state grant, and as the number of students who are eligible for that increases, which this would increase according to the fiscal note, we don't increase that number, it means then that the implication of it is that the amount per student goes down, correct? Rather than
Senator Pappas.
Reducing the number. If they're eligible, then the money is spent.
This is actually a good year to do this because the governor is recommending an $81 million increase in the state grant. So in all cases, the state grant's going to go up for all students. And the impact of this would be very minor on that increase.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that, yes, the governor and the governor has proposed an increase in the targets of the targets from the House and the Senate have both shown increases, but the money's got to come from somewhere. The money's not growing on trees, so there's a proposal for an increase in funding, but we have to raise the revenue one way or another in order for that money to be there. So I agree with Senator Sharon, and I have the same concern, and I'm not sure that we got an answer to the question. Is it okay?
So the answer to the question is there's the way the formula works is you would either have less per person or you would have some people fall out based on the qualifications, and we're going to have the state grant conversation shortly where we'll look at how different formula parts affect it, because some, depending on how you structure the formula, some changes throw people off, some lower the amount, some increase. And so all that Senator Pappas' bill does is says if you're eligible, you're just in the same boat as everybody else who's eligible, whereas Senator Pratt is carving this group out to say you're just aside and eligibility is just in those for the others until you actually are legal status. Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, I admit I have never filled out a FAFSA form. That has always gone to spousal duties. I've always asked for
it.
And I've heard the anguish of trying to fill these forms out for our children. And I'm wondering if that isn't Senator Pratt's point. And I wanted to ask counsel if he could tell us, does the FAFSA form require an applicant to be a permanent resident of the U.S. or a citizen to be eligible for
Senator Ortman, California actually designed their own FAFSA for this, and they put that in the...
But, Madam Chair, I think it's a fair question, and I would appreciate a fair answer from counsel about what the federal government requires. I think it's fair. I care about what California does, but I want to know what the federal government does.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I don't have firsthand knowledge. I've been told by OHE folks that you cannot complete a FAFSA application. If you're in this status, that's what I've been told, which is why they have to generate their own FAFSA, but I don't have firsthand knowledge of that.
Madam Chair, I think
Ortman.
That makes sense, but I guess what I'm really trying to do is understand the context. So if we adopt the A8 amendment as offered by Senator Pratt, we believe we would be following the current FAFSA eligibility requirements for Minnesota state grants. And if we don't, then we would be in the business of creating our own secondary program for state grants for these new students that qualify.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's correct.
Yep. And Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
do you have any criteria or format for that kind of an application? Have you gotten that far with this?
Madam Chair, the Office of Higher Education would be developing that, and I assume they would look at what some other states have done as a helpful model.
I think Ms. Fitzgibbons is ready to.
Might as well just stay here.
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Madam Chair, first to answer the question about whether or not the current amendment we're being considered is would just be putting into law what's already in the federal process. It actually would because of the language in the federal financial aid law, it uses the term citizen and eligible non-citizen, which is actually a larger population than citizen or permanent resident. And so it would actually impact the way we even do the financial aid right now. It would have to actually only find out who's a permanent resident as opposed to an eligible non-citizen. And for definition purposes, eligible non-citizen includes things that include statuses like refugee, asylum, other types of statuses that is not necessarily considered a permanent resident. And those students are eligible for federal financial aid, and that's why the term eligible non-citizen comes from.
Senator Ortman?
Does that mean if we do nothing and don't adopt the A8 amendment, then we would be following the current federal guidelines?
Ms. Fitzgibbons?
I have to look at the amendment again, but what's going on right now is that we're establishing a separate state version, or we would establish a state version of the FAFSA, where only those who couldn't fill out the FAFSA already would apply through the Office of Higher Ed, a state version of the FAFSA, which is what they have done in other states where they're awarding aid to students who can't go through the federal process. This amendment, or the A8 amendment, would essentially make the students eligible for resident tuition, but would mean that they would not apply for financial aid through the Office of Higher Ed. They would not be eligible. But it also could, depending on how the language is written or how it ends up being, it actually could make it so that there are other students who otherwise could fill out the FAFSA, who otherwise could qualify for federal financial aid, could not qualify for state financial aid.
Senator Pratt?
Madam Chair, my intent here is not to carve out anybody. My intent here is to maintain a current process that seems that works. So if it were to be changing permanent resident to eligible resident, I would be open to that if that's the language that would keep the current eligible students in, right? But it's not to carve out a special set of students. It's to make sure that we have the resources available to the students who are already in need, to the students that we've heard time over time don't have enough financial aid to cover the rising cost of tuition. And rather than increasing the pool and lowering the amount or causing per student and making it even harder or having students drop off the roll, at least maintaining the current pool that we have. So if it's changing permanent to eligible, I would be open to that.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I really take objection to what Senator Pratt is saying about expanding the existing pool, because that's what the achievement gap is all about. We want to eliminate the achievement gap so that students who have not traditionally been going to college, are going to college. We need them in our future workforce. So expanding the pool is exactly what we need to be doing, and the Dream Act kids are just part of expanding the pool.
So what I'd like to do, because I think people probably know how they're going to vote on this, I want to accommodate Senator Pratt's desire to change to amend his amendment, and then we're going to vote.
Well, I want to make sure that that's okay with Mr. Fuller and that doesn't have any.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I think it raises an issue, which is we don't know what that means under state law. And if your intent is to make it coextensive with people who can file a FAFSA, which is a little generic, that's what I would say, but I'm not exactly sure how permanent that sort of expression would be as the underlying FAFSA law changed. I mean, you would be at the whims of that. And
you know, I would be open to that, to say that they were eligible under the FAFSA, and I've called it FAFSA for so long as we filled it out for my son, I don't know what it really means anymore.
I don't know all that.
Madam Chair, yeah. If
Ms.
you wanted to follow it, it would be citizen or eligible non-citizen as defined by Title IV of the Higher Education Act.
As amended?
As amended.
So, all those in favor, do we have to vote on his oral amendment first before we have the amendment before us?
Is he incorporating that?
Yes, he's incorporating
no,
it. Okay, very good. Okay, pardon? Yeah, could you please read the incorporated amendment?
Mm-hmm. So, a student must be a United States citizen or an eligible non-citizen as defined by the
Title four.
Higher.
Of the Federal Education Act.
Higher Education Act.
Higher Education Act. I wrote fast, not fast enough.
And I think you said that, Madam Chair, I think you said as amended. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So all those in favor of Senator Pratt's amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion is not adopted.
Division.
All those in favor of Senator Pratt's amendment, raise your hand. All those opposed, raise. So, 1, 2, 3. I'm sorry.
Five.
Okay. Motion is adopted.
Excuse me,
Madam Chair. It was not. Can you call the vote?
I said motion is. I'm sorry. There were 5 who voted no and 7 who voted aye.
So the motion was
motion
adopted.
Is adopted, that's what I said.
Oh, no.
Just wanted to hear the call. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I'm afraid I might have been confused on my vote here. Was I voting to add this language to the A8 amendment, or was I voting on the amendment?
You were voting on the amendment.
I would like to
reconsider. So you're voting on the prevailing side.
Yes.
You move to reconsider.
Madam Chair, I was confused as well. I thought we were voting on the amendment to the amendment.
I apologize, members. Sounds like we weren't clear. We were actually voting on the amended Pratt amendment. Okay, very good.
There was no amendment.
Is everybody clear?
Are we going to move to reconsider?
Yes.
Make that motion. Yes.
Oh, okay. So Senator Sharon has moved to reconsider. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Now, on the Pratt.
Chair.
Yeah. Senator Ortman.
Just for clarification.
Thank you.
We have a motion that would say that our student aid program in Minnesota should continue to follow the federal guidelines for who qualifies for financial aid for higher education. I just want to make sure that's the gist
correct
of the amendment, and I would like to ask for a roll call.
Very good. Roll call has been requested. Roll call is granted.
Bonoff.
And so the amendment, wait 1 second, I'm sorry, there's been a request that the amendment is read.
A student must be a United States citizen or an eligible non-citizen as defined by Title IV of the Federal Higher Education Act.
To be eligible for financial aid under Chapter.
Yes. 136.
Yeah, you have to finish it.
To be eligible for financial aid under Chapter 136A.
Very good.
And Madam Chair? Madam Chair? And I would urge committee members to vote no. It really is my intention that they are eligible for financial aid.
And I support Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Yeah, this would not preclude anybody who otherwise can apply for financial aid. And once a federal process exists, they certainly would be able to apply for financial aid. Any changes in Title IV of the Higher Education Act would then authorize any new Minnesota students to apply for the program under the federal guidelines. This, I think by voting for this amendment, we're just saying we're not going to create a whole second tier of financial aid programming in the state of Minnesota. And so that's why I think it's a good amendment as it's been changed.
Yes. And Senator Ortman, I oppose the amendment because it is my intention in supporting this that we provide the same equal access to those who would become eligible. But Senator Peterson and then Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, I do think people know how they want to vote, so we do have so many things on the agenda today, but I will, go ahead, Senator Peterson.
We have a fiscal note on the impact of the state grant.
Senator Peterson, I don't know if you were here, but I said I wouldn't carry a fiscal impact in my bill because we're not going to increase the state grant pool based on these new residents. They would have to compete with everybody else. So there would not be an added cost to the state grant total dollars. They would take some of our state grant dollars. Senator Sharon.
And I just want to make clear that my question about that was to make that transparent. Doesn't mean I'm not going to vote for this, but I'm voting understanding.
Yes.
That it is a finite amount of money, and when you add more students' eligibility to it, and we're going to argue about how this formula works to distribute this, that it adds more student eligibility to a finite amount of money, and then it creates a probability that it has an impact.
Yes.
Not maybe on our state's budget, but on the access of revenue to all students who are applying for this in the state.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, members, can we, Senator Miller?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just have a quick question. Do we know if, will the current pool of students get less, or will people drop off? Which one will it be? Or
Senator Miller, we won't know until we go through. Well, we can, I guess, using the existing formula, we would know. But we are going to make some changes to the state grant program that will be impacted. But go ahead, please, Meredith.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, I'm Meredith Fergus. I am the state grant analyst for the Office of Higher Education. I can't remember exactly how many students. Was it 315, Megan? 333. This is the equivalent of adding two students at every college in Minnesota. It truly is a margin of error that the program can accommodate within its current allocation formula. Furthermore, the $539,000 per year is equivalent to 0.03 of the state grant budget. So we really have the resources to accommodate it. Sorry.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Meredith, could you please say that again? You see, we've been talking about these numbers and these exclusions of these children who actually qualified, have played by the rules to come to college and are doing everything they can to go to college. And we're talking about a few thousand dollars here, and we have all of these amendments in order to exclude them from going to college, and we're so worried that they're going to exhaust every resource for higher education, and they are going to cause tremendous harm to the state budget and state at the higher education budget. Could you please read that
Senator
again?
Torres-Ray, I just want to caution you that we don't align any members' motives
I'm just saying we have a serious concern about the money, and it's so important that we hear the
actual
fact.
That's valid. I just want to caution you, be careful. Okay, very good.
Madam Chair and members, now that I've kind of caught my breath, sure. It is the equivalent of adding two students at every college in the state, of those colleges who are state grant eligible. In addition, the $539,000 is the equivalent of 0.03 of the state grant budget. It is well within our margin of error as we go forward with state appropriations. So while it will, if all these students come in and if current projections hold, it would likely decrease the amount that each student would get. That average decrease would likely be about $1 to $2.
Okay, very good. We're going to vote on the amendment.
Senator Ortman. I'm sorry, but I have a question for you. Under the current federal law, we have non-eligible non-citizens, right? And so the folks that are applying through a potential pathway to citizenship would graduate along that path to citizenship, and so many of them would become eligible non-citizens, and they would also have the incentive then of also qualifying for financial aid, would they not, if we followed the federal guidelines and also then did not implement our own program. There would be a graduated system of grandfathering them in and an incentive.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I'm actually going to defer to Megan on that question because she has the more technical definition knowledge.
Madam Chair, Senators, if you're referring to the federal process, which may in some point in the future exist, from what I have seen of that in the discussions that the Federal Dream Act, they wouldn't necessarily qualify for federal financial aid immediately. They wouldn't fall under that eligible non-citizen. They may at some point down the line, whatever it says, but it wouldn't be an immediate. In addition, the current Department of Homeland Security policy called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals does not make those individuals eligible for federal financial aid. So they currently would not qualify under that, and they may at some point in the future in that federal process. But again, I'm not an immigration attorney. I don't know all that specifically, but that would be my understanding.
Thank you.
Very good. A roll call has been requested. Let's take the roll.
Bonoff.
No.
Clausen.
No.
Eakin.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Kent.
No.
Lori.
No.
Miller.
Yes.
Ortman.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Pratt.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Sparks. Torres Ray.
No.
There being four yes votes and eight no votes, the motion did not prevail. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I would like to offer the A11 amendment. Madam Chair, while it's being distributed, if I could talk to the purpose of the amendment.
Senator Ortman.
We've talked quite a bit, Senator Pappas and members, about encouraging Minnesota students to get higher education and to go to college, and I agree with that goal. And I also agree that if we are investing in our colleges and universities, then we are investing in Minnesota students. And I know that the business community has come forward and said they support this, and the higher education institutions have come forward and said they support this. But I want to make sure that the focus is educating Minnesota residents. And one of the beautiful things about the bill that you're proposing, Senator Pappas, is it automatically increases the diversity at these colleges and universities. I don't think they need to look elsewhere to encourage diversity. I think our goal should be to educate as many Minnesota residents as we possibly can, including those that have come up through our K-12 program. And say, Senator Torres Ray, you of all people would know just how much we invest in our K-12 programs. I want those students then to qualify for the University of Minnesota. I want them to get in, and I'd like to see our universities and colleges, Minsky University of Minnesota, implement a 75% threshold for Minnesota residents.
Madam Chair, I guess I am not aware of any Minsky institution that has a non-Minnesota resident rate of more than 25%, but I would have to ask Minsky if that would impact them.
Senator Pappas, how about the University of Minnesota, though?
Mm-hmm.
They're not included.
Oh, they're not included.
They're requested.
They are included.
They are included in her bill.
They're intended to be.
Higher education.
They're requested to be included. So it's their
Madam
call.
Chair?
They're intended to be included.
Madam Chair. My understanding, the University of Minnesota may want to speak to this directly, but my understanding is that the University of Minnesota is right around 75% right now. I also would express there are institutions such as Carleton and McAllister that have much higher percentages of out-of-state students, and they do participate in the state grant program.
So we're talking, Madam Chair, about reciprocity students as well from Wisconsin or from North Dakota, because you're saying Minnesota residents. And so I guess I feel like this is kind of micromanaging our state institutions.
Senator Pappas, I have a question on the amendment because I'm being directed by counsel that this doesn't apply to the University of Minnesota, and I'm trying to understand why. Well, Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, it's my intention that this would apply to the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities program, but not to a private college. I don't think that we have any business regulating that. But I think that if we are going to expand the group of applicants from Minnesota to our universities and colleges that are state-funded,
I think that we should make sure that Minnesota residents have the highest priority for those educational opportunities. That's all I'm saying here. And I'm glad to hear that the University of Minnesota is close to 75%. It was my understanding that they were in the lower 60s. But I would be surprised if it had any impact at all on MinSCU. My belief is that they're probably well above the 75%. So it shouldn't have much impact on the University of Minnesota either if they're saying that they're already at about that rate. But that gives us some reassurance that we are focusing on educating Minnesota residents. And when the business community says we want more students that are eligible and study high tech and science and medical students in Minnesota at our colleges and state universities because they're looking for that talent here in Minnesota, let's make sure we're educating Minnesota students as much as possible. That's my goal, and I think that it makes perfect sense to say, let's expand the applicants for the University of Minnesota and all these colleges, but let's make sure that they're focusing on educating Minnesota residents.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
We are talking about educating Minnesota residents.
Right.
These students are Minnesota residents. In fact, we have a higher standard for them than for other students. Other people who come to Minnesota are considered Minnesota residents after living here 1 year than they are legal Minnesota residents. I think it's only 30 days to be able to vote. So these students have to be here for 3 years at a Minnesota high school and graduate from a Minnesota high school. So in some ways, we have an unfair and a higher standard in my bill for these Minnesota students. So I really take offense to the implication that these are not Minnesota students, number one. Number two,
Madam Chair, I didn't imply that at all.
No. Senator Pappas, what it sounded like.
No,
you said
not at all. In fact, Senator the opposite Pappas, is no. true. The opposite is true. You wrote the 3-year requirement, Senator Pappas, not me. I'm just saying that we want to focus our educational opportunities on Minnesota residents. And Senator, they are all Minnesota residents, and by your bill, they will be qualified. They will count. That's what I'm agreeing with you.
But the bill says that in order for them to be eligible, the university and MinSCU must be at a 75% Minnesota level is how I'm hearing the bill. And to me, Senator Ortman, that gets into our performance metrics that we're going to be working on. And so you may have an amendment to my performance metrics article because you may want them. I would urge members to vote no because I don't think this is the place for that. If you want to focus the university and MinSCU to serve Minnesota students, we should have that discussion and people should argue and vote and debate the merits. I would ask that members around the committee table not conflate the two issues because I don't think they're related. But I hear that's important in your view, and I think you should have a lot of time to discuss the merits of that. And so,
well, Madam Chair, I probably would have gone to 80%, but I think it's that regardless of your bill, Senator Pappas, this is an issue that I've been very concerned about, that we have students all over the state that are getting a B-plus average at one of our very fine high schools and not getting admitted into the University of Minnesota. And I'm saying you're adding to the applicant pool and the admissions pool, and I think that's great. But I just want to make sure that when we do that, we're not keeping Minnesota students out in the effort to have diversity, because I think we're adding diversity with the resident population of Minnesota. I think that's a good thing. I just want to make sure we're focused on educating as many Minnesota students as possible.
Okay, can we just vote on that one? Very good. Senator Ortman moves to amend Senate File 723 with the A11. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Okay, next.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention something that the immigration lawyer mentioned to me, and I don't know if we can resolve this today, but maybe it's some language that Mr. Fuller could work on, that on the A-10 amendment, we probably have to be more specific in defining the federal process, that it's a new federal process, and that it's a federal process for students, because there are existing processes for immigration that are in place. They're just not adequate to meet the needs of the student population. So if it's all right with the committee, I don't know if we can come up with that language right now. And Senator Ortman, I just wanted to ask you your permission if we could work on that language between now and finance to just be a little bit more specific about the federal process.
Madam Chair, forgive me, but Senator Sharon and I were talking about something else. So in the bill, could you just repeat that?
The immigration lawyer who was just sitting next to me said that we probably have to be more specific in defining that it's a federal process for students, that it would be a new federal process, not some federal process that might already exist, and that we might just have to be a little bit more specific. So if you would just work with me and Mr. Fuller on being more, you know, we could define that between now and full finance.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, of course, I would be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres Wright.
Thank you. Senator Pappas and Mr. Keller is in the audience, but the student provision is already in the senator's amendment. It does say if a federal process exists for the student. So the student portion is in it.
Well, Madam Chair, read the rest of the sentence, though, because it could say for the student to obtain lawful immigration status. So it depends whether for the student modifies the federal process or for the student modifies obtain lawful immigration process status. So I think it might be better to have the language before federal process.
Thank you.
Very good. So Senator Claussen moves that Senate File 723, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
And, Madam Chair, that's to go to full finance.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, and a dual process because it is also potentially being laid over as part of the omnibus bill. So it's moving and it's a dual process as potentially laid over as part of the omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, members, for a very good discussion.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay. So, members, we're going to do another bill quickly before we do the grants because there's people waiting who have to leave, and the grants is a longer conversation. I apologize. Senator Champion's been so patient. But, Senator Champion, it was a good conversation you got to be a part of. Thank you.
This was your bill.
It was wonderful.
So, Senator Peterson.
I knew it was.
He's assured me this is a non-controversial bill. And I was really willing to do this, Senator Peterson, because I heard Representative Creasel was here, and I was so looking forward to seeing Representative Creasel. Welcome to the committee. It's been a long time.
Hello. I'm kind of tired of hearing about him, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, indeed, it should be a non-controversial bill. I'm here to talk about Senate File 1467, which... and I'll be brief, really gets at one of the key issues that faces our veteran population in the state of Minnesota and across this country, which is about them having opportunities to get gainful employment. A lot of our veterans come back and they have a disparity in opportunities and employment. There's an employment gap between our veteran population and the population at large. This is a bill that is, I think, fairly common sense, and I say that knowing that it oftentimes turns into not being so much, but I think this one is. We've talked to the MNSCU system, and they actually have already gotten started on this program on their own. But what it does essentially is say that if you have skills that you've developed and high-quality training that you've had in the military, you can apply that towards a reasonable amount of college credits, not just your physical education credits, but all around. Obviously, we have highly technical individuals who have worked in high-pressure environments in the military, oftentimes maybe even constructing bridges and wastewater treatment plants and all sorts of things, law enforcement and what have you. So I also brought along a few testifiers who would like to say a few words in support, and thank you for the time, Madam Chair and Committee.
Representative Peterson, Senator Peterson, excuse me. Thank you so much for bringing this forward.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is John Creasel. I'm a recovering state representative and a 10-year Army veteran, served in Iraq and Kosovo. I'm testifying in support of this bill. I think... it's definitely a step in the right direction. When people volunteer to go and join the military, deploy overseas, they put themselves oftentimes by being selfless and sacrificing for their country, they come back at a disadvantage because while they're off protecting our freedom, everyone back here in their same age group is going to college, getting ahead in the job search. So this is a way to help level the playing field, translate a lot of that real-world military experience to some college credits and help them become more marketable and find gainful employment.
And Representative Creasel, what was your educational situation when you came back?
When I came back, I attempted college, dropped out, and it was tough with the family in that situation, but if there had been something like this in place, I certainly would have continued going to college. I felt like having to be there for my kids and my wife after having been gone so long,
yeah,
it was really tough to devote myself to college when it looked and it was just a big, long road ahead. This would definitely have helped that situation. And so I hope you all would support this, and maybe I'll go back to college then.
And have you looked at how many credits you might be eligible for if this were to pass? Have you had any conversations?
Under this legislation, I have not. But I would expect that it would be a master's degree at least, right?
Well, you look and you let us know.
Okay. Madam Chair, I know we're crunched for time, but maybe another day, Ms. Hugh can give a presentation on what they've already started.
Great.
And we've got a lot of work to do, but it's pretty cool.
We'd really love that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Vitzen, and I'm the director of the Anoka County Workforce Center. We're the administrative agent for the Workforce Center. We serve about 700 veterans a year that are looking for jobs or looking to go to school. And we're here to speak in support of the bill. And just want to mention a couple things why we support it. Obviously, you've heard of the need for skilled workers. We're expecting a much younger population to be coming, and soon the number of college graduates is supposed to be less than what the demand is in the labor market. It's hard to see that coming through the recession, but that is the projection. And we need all the people we can get to get in the educational track. It provides more income from those individuals. Obviously, higher education typically has yielded better wages. The other thing I'd like to just mention, veterans are good risk, and they're a good population to really concentrate on. They're higher educated than the general population in terms of high school graduate. They're almost all high school graduates. They don't have a lot of college education coming out. And so it's a good population to really center in on. They have good financial aid package compared to other students, relatively speaking. Recent changes have really made it a lot more incentive to go to college. And so that's an advantage in terms of serving these folks. The other thing is that they're a group that's fairly easy to assess prior learning. You think about our general population, it'd be hard for a college to do that. There's so many employers, hundreds of thousands of employers in the United States, and hundreds of thousands of occupational areas. So, but in the military, it's relatively few, and it's very well documented. And the military has really done a much better job in the last 4 or 5 years of putting that together. All the military services now are joining just recently to have those transcripts come across the same way to schools. So it's a lot easier now for schools to assess that. The other thing is just the some studies have indicated very clearly that people that get credit for prior learning persist in school longer and have a higher graduation rate. So that kind of little bit of incentive that you get kind of keeps you going. You kind of look behind here, and I got something to start with. And then finally, I just want to speak about the institutions in Minnesota have done a real nice job, particularly MinSCU, of evaluating credits. They have a very sophisticated system right now that schools can use in MinSCU. They've kind of stepped up to the plate. Should make it a lot easier for us to do this. And just finally, if you ever find a few dollars, you might think of giving some incentives to those schools that do a good job of evaluating veterans, because it is an expensive process. They still have to go through and look at what the individuals did, and that takes a lot of staff time to do that. But thank you, and we want to voice our support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm David Leon with the Department of Military Affairs. I'm the Director of Support to Military Operations. And we'd like to say that Military Affairs does support House File 1467. This bill will allow greater flexibility for the higher education system to give credit for military schools and training. Currently, the American Council on Education makes recommendations for granting credit for military schools and training, but that's really based on the service member's rank, the length of service, and their MOS, which is really their job in the military and really isn't based on the training that they've taken. And allowing this flexibility for the higher education system would allow these service members to get the credit that's really due. You know, and lastly, if higher education is granted this flexibility to allow credit for military schools and training, it may, and I say may, reduce the amount that comes out of the general fund for the appropriation to military affairs for state tuition reimbursement that reimburses all our soldiers and airmen for tuition reimbursement costs.
Very good. Well, thank you. Questions? Senator Torres Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, how does the current how does this system work? Who does the revision? Would it be every institution is responsible for actually looking and reviewing and figuring out how to get a credit? I mean, whether or not they accepted a particular training course for a credit, mm-hmm. and then. If are other states doing this right now? Are you aware of any other states who actually do this currently?
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres Ray. Actually, we have the luxury in Minnesota of having really a nation-leading state college and university system as it relates to this area in terms of awarding credit for veteran services already. So that infrastructure is kind of in place, and the ball is already moving in that direction. As far as how they quantify the skills related to each job code, it is done by job code and what the minimum qualification is for the person that is doing that job in the military. So whatever it is, if it, say it's law enforcement, there's a certain set of training that individual has to go through, and they have that cataloged. MNSCU actually has a web-based portal that you can log into and say, okay, you are an MP, for example. You get 9 credits for that, the equivalent of 9 credits for the training that they know goes into every, every recruit's training in that job code. So, and that's kind of to the point of the earlier testifiers. It's formalized across the armed services, and so you don't have to wonder about whether or not this person has had that training. As opposed to the private sector, which may or may not have rigorous training for the particular jobs that they have. So that's kind of how they flesh out what qualifications and what skills these people have.
And Senator Torres Ray, I would like to, once the omnibus bill has been put together, I would like to have a hearing where MNSCU presents this whole thing to us. I think it's really interesting.
Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray.
And just to follow up on that, I think that there will be a tremendous value of having kind of a central location to do this. For international students, students have to translate their documentation and then send it to an institution that is actually assigned to assign credits because they know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it would be great for us to, so that there is consistency across all colleges and post-secondary institutions, and they, adopt, they give recommendation for credits on specific, training courses or whatever is. I think that establishing some consistency would be of great value, and we could fund that process. I think that will be helpful for the state.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, too, Senator. Senator Peterson, I support this. And my question would be, perhaps this is what the chair was meaning when we have a review on this, that when I read this, I thought that we had already done this. I thought that we'd already initiated legislation that required that a system be developed in which you evaluate like a medic's learning or that could be translated into actual credits at the university. So this I see spokes about service course curriculum. Maybe that expands to course curriculum rather than just experience of a medic. That's my example in service delivery. But I'd be curious to know how this goes beyond what it is that I thought we were already doing.
And it looks like
And if that's not the case, then I'm very interested to know why that fell apart or where that went.
And it looks like it's very unorthodox that we actually have a current representative at the table. I don't know if we allow that in the Senate. I don't think that's Senate rules. But Senator Lurie.
Not let this go. I mean, Senator Peterson, you've been elected to the Senate now. I count at least seven.
Do you want me to give
current and former reps in the room here? You're going to outnumber us pretty quick, and this is going to be frowned upon. I mean,
bringing people together.
Representative Abler, do you have a comment on that?
Just brief, Madam Chair. I met a fellow who had served two terms in Afghanistan. Yeah, we're out of, you know, the House member just gets the chair. he went to Minskew, and they gave him a FIAD credit for his MP experience. And so I think Minskew is trying hard, and just to give them credit for their good intent. But I've noticed in my work, the more we encourage them in this good intent, that stuff will happen. And if you know the whole thing about credit transfers, and I think they're at 91% or something, and the more we can give incentives to these young men and women coming out of the military to get their lives back together, the better. And so the bill, we wrote it very friendly without demanding anything, just to encourage them along their way with some positive language to help them be creative and flexible and to give these men and women their due, because they know a lot. And a person serving two terms in Afghanistan as an MP probably has half his police work done, at least, I would think, and not just one FIAD credit. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Sharon, we had a bill that Senator Fischbach put forward, and that's what's triggering the memory. And it was a little bit different, and we did actually intend to put that in the omnibus bill, too, but it gave and Minskew testified about it. So,
Senator Bonifant, I'm talking about when Senator Pappas was the chair of this committee, we had a number of pieces of legislation that said that we ought to be doing some analytics about how you transfer experience, not just with the military,
right?
Not just with the military, but in lots of other places for people who have been working in the workforce and very active and engaged and have competencies to bring them back into higher education. And to figure out a way to give credit for experiential learning. So I'm just surprised, and I'd like, as a part of the conversation, to know, what's the problem? Why does it just turn out to be a FIAD credit and not something more more than that? Not just in relationship to this, but to a lot of the other areas where experiential learning ought to be evaluated and given acknowledgement and credit.
Madam Very Chair good. And Senator Sharon, you can now know for sure that the direction has been given with Senate File 1467.
So. Very good. So Senator Peterson moves that Senate 1467 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you very much. Okay, state grant time. Senator Eakin and Champion together at the table. We're breaking all the rules, and we want Senator Peterson's book called First Break the Rules. So Senator Eakin and Senator Champion have similar bills. So they're going to sit with each other and present them. And members, we aren't going to vote on a state grant bill today, but what we are going to do is hear from Senator Eakin and Senator Champion their proposed changes to the state grant program, and then I'm actually going to offer an alternative proposed change, and then we're going to let people talk about it. We're going to make sure to end that discussion in time to let Senator Kent do at least one of her bills. So we'll make sure to wrap this up 5:15-ish, okay?
Thank you.
Very good. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you had stated, Senator Champion and I have similar bills to address the same issue of part-time students. And there was an issue regarding part-time students who work, that they are not receiving the same amount of grant and aid per credit as full-time students or even part-time students who are not working. And we felt that, one should not be penalized for working while trying to pay for college. And many of these people who are working are doing so not because they just choose to go part-time, but because of economic necessity or because of family responsibilities, working and their working responsibilities on top of that. And we felt that it's important, especially now there's been talk about the need to expand the pool of those going to college because of the baby boomers who are retiring in large numbers. We need more highly educated workforce now than we ever have. So we want to encourage people to go to college, and young people and adults alike. And that's one of the things this is designed to do, to make college more affordable for them, especially those who are struggling the most to get by and are working at the same time. I think it's important to note as well that there is an increase in the number of part-time students that are going to college now. And part of that is because, again, of economic necessity and also the time constraints that are placed on many who are going to college. I know there's going to be some talk in regard to the importance of attending full-time for full-time students have been known to have better graduation rates. But the fact is, I think if we're not providing assistance to the part-time students, there are many of those who drop out and don't finish college because they can't afford it. And we certainly don't want that to be happening again at a time when we want to expand the number of people who are going to college, not be constricting it. So with that, I think I'll just turn it over to my colleague, Senator Champion, to say a few points as well before we have some of our testifiers speak.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing us to break the rules just a little so I could be here with someone so eloquent as Senator Eakin. And so I always look forward to being here and talking about an issue that I believe to be very important. Education, as you know, is the great equalizer. And I know that being a person who grew up in North Minneapolis and after attending North High School, I often tell people that I had to catch 3 buses to school each day because I didn't have enough money to stay on the McAllister College campus. And then I would go home every day. But that experience also informed me just not of my own experience at school, but also others who may not have had the opportunity to have mom and dad at home making a contribution to their college journey. But I don't believe that it is the intent of this great body and our forefathers for us to turn our back on or not raise the level of concern around making sure all of our students have a wonderful opportunity and a fair shot at graduating from school. So when we think in terms of our part-time students, here's the problem, as I understand it. I must admit that I'm not on the education committee, so I want to just make sure that you know that first and foremost. But here's what I understand to be the problem, that the Pell Grant prorates the full-time Pell Award fairly for part-time students who work. And the state grant prorates the full-time award fairly for part-time students who don't work enough to contribute towards paying for the cost of their education. But the state grant does not prorate full-time awards for part-time students who do work enough to contribute towards paying for the cost of their education. As a result, working students, as Senator Eakin talked about, gets less support from the state grant per credit hour than do full-time students or part-time students who do not work. The solution is simple from my vantage point. Prorate what the Minnesota Office of Higher Education calls the Assigned Family Responsibility, or the AFR, so that together the Pell Grant and the Minnesota State Grant match the student's level of enrollment. This approach is simple, predictable for students, and matches the treatment that the state grant program already gives to part-time students who don't work or who have a 0 assigned family responsibility. This change annually produces an additional $17 million for part-time students, with roughly $10 to $11 million going to Minscu students. This would benefit 9,900 part-time working students in total. Of the 9,900, approximately 8,000 students are at Minscu institutions, 7,300 in colleges, and 700 in universities. This proposal before you is only for working part-time students. It is for all working part-time students. It does not discriminate either a person that is dependent, independent, parent, non-parent, old, young, married, single, public private school students from every system of higher education in the state will benefit. According to the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed, as projections of the costs and effects of this proposal, roughly the same number of students from non-profit private schools benefit as will benefit from state universities. Currently, the state grant program treats part-time students who work in a regressive manner. It provides them with less grant funding per credit than it would if they were full-time students. And under the part-time proposal, the amount of a student's grant is based on the student or the student's family ability to pay. And it is exactly as progressive as the state grant treatment or part-time students who don't work. The part-time proposal simply expresses the belief that working students who pay for part of the cost of their education should receive state grants prorated to their level of enrollment, which is the treatment already received by students who don't pay for any of the cost of their education. The facts are that students who contribute towards paying for the cost of their education and attend less than full-time, perhaps because they are working or perhaps because of family obligations, receive substantially less state grants per credit than they would if they attended full-time. Students who do not contribute anything towards the cost of their education receive exactly the same state grant per credit that they would if they attended full-time. Under the proposal, a part-time working student's Pell Grant is included in the state grants calculation exactly as it is under current rules. State policymakers, I know that we can't address every shortcoming in federal need analysis or Pell Grant funding, but we can change state policy to reflect the very real needs of the state's actual students. It may very well be true that some students attending colleges part-time are doing so by choice, particularly if they aren't working to pay for their schooling. However, students who work and contribute towards meeting the cost of their education attend college part-time by necessity, either economic necessity, the necessity for caring for children, or educational necessity. Someone working 30 hours a week may not succeed if they enroll full-time. There simply isn't enough time in the day to do everything that they need to. Although grants for part-time students may be exactly the right size to address the cost for a traditional recent high school graduate who is attending a private college, they are not the right size to address the cost of the thousands of working adults and parents who attend post-secondary institutions in Minnesota. If they were, these students would not be borrowing student loans. Investing in state resources to help at-risk students who are making a good effort to help themselves despite trying circumstances is the best use Minnesota can make of its state grant funds. This investment will pay for itself many times over if it helps these students to succeed, regardless of whether they take 4 or 8. We believe that it's important in order to make sure that we provide an opportunity for these students to make it through every school. And the last thing that I'll say, and I know,
because I just want to get everybody to talk.
Oh, okay, no. Last thing that I'll say, Madam Chair, before questions, is that there has to be a shared responsibility and a shared responsibility for us to make the necessary investments. And I've heard some people say that if it's a part-time student who's going to a Minsky school and not maybe a private school or whatever, that perhaps they their projections are not as great to make the same great income as someone else. And I would have to just differ with that, because I think if we make the necessary investments, we will be surprised what a person will have the ability to do if we provide a pathway for them to be successful. And how can I say that? Because I am a person who is sitting before you who had to do what? Make it every single day in order to make it to school. And education has changed the outcome of my life and therefore the trajectory of my life. And so I think we should make sure that there's an opportunity for our students. And so with that,
as said by a McAllister grad.
Absolutely. A proud Mac grad,
that's,
I might
right.
add.
Very good. Thank you so much. All right. And I think the students wanted to be called on next.
Madam Chair?
Oh, yeah.
Real quick, before we go to the students, because I am interested in hearing, but I do try to kind of review handouts as they come. And we got like, there's one sentence here. We got like 7 handouts, several of them really in-depth spreadsheets, and I'm not sure what we're supposed to take from this. I know
Senator
you have
Lurie, here's what I was going to do.
Amendment coming. Maybe you could just give us an orient us a little bit so that we can try to absorb this and be ready for the conversation.
I was going to let the testifiers go first, and then I was actually going to have our expert on the state grant program come and talk about how these changes would affect the state grant. After that happens, then I was going to put forward an alternative to look at and then give you a handout that would compare how those changes would...
We already have that handout.
Okay, that one, yeah. Would affect... change mine. But I would ask that you just put them aside and just let our testifiers share why they believe passionately, and we're going to do our best. And we aren't going to vote on this, and so we're going to spend some good quality time in committee. This is going to be one of our key decision points. I would say this, as well as performance funding in terms of what we end up putting in the bill. So this is to get some stuff before us. Okay, very good.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm not a student, but I am somebody that has been very interested in students and trying to give them a voice. My name is Robert Erickson. I was Senior Vice President of Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota from 1991 to 95, and then I was appointed by Governor Carlson to be a trustee of the Minnesota State College and Universities from 1996 to 2002. During the time that I was on the board at Minsku, I chaired the Finance Committee, and part of that role, I chaired the tuition hearings. As I chaired those tuition hearings, I became very much aware of what I will say was really a serious equity issue, and that equity issue relates to part-time students. It's something that I took very much to heart, and when I left the Minsky Board, I started to ride my bicycle, and I rode my bicycle for 6 years, a total of over 14,000 miles, to every campus, every Minsky campus in the state, 6 times, and we managed to raise about $350,000, but I think hopefully more importantly, start to get this issue talked about, because what's happened is the world has changed a lot since I started college. When I started school at the University of Minnesota in 1963, my tuition was $105 a quarter, $315 for the year. The minimum wage was $1.25 an hour. So I had to work 250 hours to pay my tuition. It wasn't terribly hard. Today, at the University of Minnesota, the tuition's $14,000, roughly. If you divide that by 8, you have something like 1,700 plus hours. If you want to go to one of the state universities, you're looking at roughly $8,000, which is 1,000 hours. And even at our community colleges and technical colleges, which at the time that I started school, I think the technical colleges were essentially free, and the community colleges were very cheap. So we're dealing with a situation where even at our community and technical colleges, you're having to work something on the order of 600 hours just to pay your tuition. Now, as I've looked at this issue, again, over and over again, and there are technical experts that can talk about this better than I can, but I want to talk to you from the heart, because I think when we look at equity issues, we have to look at how people better themselves in life. And the poster child that I've had for this particular issue is a single parent making $25,000 a year that only has time to take one course a semester. If you're in that situation, in most situations, there may be some extreme situations where something magic happens, but most of the time, that student will get no financial aid, no federal, no state. Obviously, at that level, you don't have the funds to pay for a course. So when you are asked, ask yourself the question, how can I better myself? And you're probably already up to your ears in debt, the answer gets to be it's very, very difficult. So I am very strongly in support of what's being talked about. I think that I don't know. I'm not going to dwell on the mechanics of the bills, but I would strongly urge you to look at this changing the system. I think it's something that has served the state well over many years, but like many things, it's time to change, and I think just the fact that what's the shift that's occurred in higher education putting much more burden on the student has taken and changed the dynamics. So,
thank you very much, and thank you for your work at Minsky.
Thank you.
Okay, next. Mariah, we've met you before, but introduce yourself again for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mariah Miles, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for allowing me to address you today. Our organization represents the seven Minsky State Universities, including Winona, Moorhead, Southwest, Mankato, Metro, Bemidji, and St. Cloud. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate File 660 and 999. Our students support treating working part-time students equitably by prorating the assigned family responsibility. Although we do not serve an enormous number of part-time students on our campuses, the trends are quickly changing. As the number of part-time college students has grown, addressing these students' unmet financial needs has become a bigger issue for Minnesota. Between fall 2008 and fall 2012, part-time students' headcount at Minsky colleges and universities increased by more than 15,000 students, a 17.6% increase. Today, nearly half of all students at Minsky colleges and universities attend part-time. Underrepresented students, minority students, low-income students, and first-generation students account for more than half of all part-time students. Unfortunately, there is a problem with the way the current state grant program formula works. It penalizes low-income students who work out of necessity and attend school part-time. As a result, these working part-time students get less support from the state grant per credit hour than full or part-time working students who do not work. Part-time students who do not work. Fortunately, there is a simple solution. Adjust the state grant formula to prorate awards for working part-time students to match their level of enrollment. This is precisely how the Pell Grant works. This simple change would open the benefits of the program to nearly 10,000 working part-time students across the state who need financial aid assistance to complete their degrees. The change will help these students at any college or university in the state they choose to attend. This will help ensure success for students traditionally underserved by higher education and help more students finish their programs in a timely fashion. Last month, our organization emailed a survey to students identified in our database as part-time students attending a Minsky university. The survey was open for just 1 week. During this time, we had 538 students respond. The high number of respondents gave a clear indication that this issue is very important to our students. Of the students responding to the survey, 320 met the criteria established by MSUSA for this report. The criteria is as follows. 1, attending a Minsky university. 2, enrolled part-time. 3, pursuing a bachelor's degree. 4, independent student for financial aid purposes. And 5, having income not including financial aid funding. We have included a survey in your materials today, and it looks like this. And I've been watching, and I'm not sure if you all have this, but could you dig through your materials? Perfect. There are some very interesting findings in this survey. First, more than 50% of the students that responded had dependent children, an income less than $60,000 per year, and are first-generation college students. These are the exact students we need to invest in as they work to complete their degrees. Also, the ages of the respondents told a very clear story as well. Only 8% of the respondents are ages 20 to 24. 39% were ages 25 to 34. 33% were ages 35 to 44. And 20% were over the age of 45. I also find it interesting that we had 3 students that were over the age of 60. More than 90% of the part-time students who responded to the survey have had transferred credits to the university they were currently attending. The majority were also in at least their third year of school. These are the students that made a decision to return and work to complete their degree. Students responding to the survey were asked several questions about how they are paying for their higher education expenses. More than 75% indicated they worked at least 30 hours per week while attending school, while nearly 40% said they worked more than 40 hours per week. A significant number of part-time students, more than 70%, responding to the survey have used a credit card to pay for expenses related to higher education, and nearly half have paid their tuition and fees through a credit card. In the Student Finance Survey sent out by MSUSA in 2011, part-time students were approximately twice as likely to use credit cards to pay for their needs related to higher education, presumably because fewer financial aid options were made available to them. Although 38% of the respondents indicated they currently receive the federal Pell Grant, the number of students who indicated they were Minnesota State Grant recipients was significantly lower, approximately half the number of who received the Pell Grant. A lack of available grant funding is likely leading to higher student debt levels and may also be related to how quickly these students can obtain their degree. Many of these students are among the 10,000 new students who would receive a state grant under the Senate File 660 and Senate File 999. However, the most important part of the survey can be found in the bottom of the last page. Students responding to the survey who were current or past Minnesota state grant recipients were asked how a larger state grant award would help them. More than 90% indicated it would or may help reduce their student loan debt, and 87% said it would or may help them complete their degree faster. As part of this survey, we also asked students to comment. We have gone through the hundreds of comments and have highlighted a few in this handout. I want to share a few resounding themes the comments showed. A student from Metro State University, where two-thirds of the students that attend are part-time, said, "I have to slow down the number of credits I can take, thereby delaying my graduation into the future sometime." A student from Winona State commented, "The rising cost of higher education has affected me dramatically. I am a single mother of three children, and I pursued my education to provide a better life for them. With the debt I accrued being so high, I have no idea how or if I will ever be able to pay, ever be able to afford paying it off or being able to move forward in my life." I urge you to read over the comments and see the students describing in their own words the challenges they are facing. Opponents of this proposal will tell you that these students are not worth investing in because they are less likely to complete their degrees, and this legislation could deter students from attending full-time. Our survey clearly shows that degree-seeking students are probably more likely to complete their degree and finish it faster if they were treated fairly under the state grant program. I also want to remind the committee that the state grant program is capped at eight semesters or 4 years. So if a student wants to receive their full grant for the duration of their college career, they must complete in 4 years. If a student is able to go full-time, they will continue to do so because the aid from the state will be much higher and they will run out if they don't finish on time. We must realize these students are not choosing to go part-time because they're lazy, but other responsibilities in their lives have had to come first. As a student from Metro State commented in the survey, "The rising cost has affected me because I'm a single parent trying to get an education so I can find and obtain a career. I have to work a part-time job because I need the money to support my family. Since I have to work a part-time job, I am unable to study as much as I would like since I only have so much time in a day." These are the students who need this extra help. They are the first generation college students, the minority students, the students we need educated to ensure Minnesota has a highly skilled 21st century workforce. We ask the committee to support this proposal, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Ms. Miles, you're always so impressive. Thank you for coming before us. I know we have another student. I would just ask, it's Ms. Charpentier-Berg, that please don't repeat things that have been said in the interest of time. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Charpentier-Berg. I'm a dually enrolled student at Anoka Ramsey Community College and North Hennepin Community College. I'm working to attain an Associate of Arts degree with an emphasis in psychology and an Associate in Science degree in paralegal studies. Upon graduation, I plan to earn my bachelor's degree and to eventually get my Juris Doctorate. My career goal is to become a legal advocate. As a single parent, I returned to school to provide more stable income for my three children, Dylan, Kristen, and Alexis. I first enrolled in a for-profit university with just 10 credits left to attain my degree. I found out that it was no longer licensable in the state of Minnesota to the tune of $25,000 worth of student loan debt. After that discovery, I started researching schools in Minnesota and found that the most affordable accredited option for me was an Oak Ramsey Community College. I apologize, I'm a little nervous.
You're doing great. Thank you for sharing your story.
My daughter, Kristen, is autistic. Because of her disability, that's why I started pursuing psychology. During the process, I found out that to be a legal advocate for your own child in the state, you have to have a law license. So the change of majors came from there. I recently married my middle school sweetheart,
who also works part-time and goes to school part-time. So we're both part-time students. When I first started school, I attempted to go full-time, working 60 hours a week between three jobs. Due to my hectic schedule, my GPA suffered. I was not able to get scholarships or merit-based aid due to my GPA. To be successful in school, I was forced to reduce my credit load. I started a work-study position and still work nights and weekends at a group home. The fewer credits helped me to focus on my classes as well as working 40 hours a week and serving as a student body president at Anoka Ramsey Community College. This semester, I'm taking 10 credits and working two jobs. My state grant is $135. My family has to be my first priority because I need to support my children. I'm unable to attend school full-time. I would like to be enrolled full-time and be closer to completing both of my degrees, but this is just not a possibility. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it, and congratulations on your dedication to both your children and your career.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Stanton, are you going to finish?
And Madam Chair, as Mr. Stanton comes, if there are any technical questions, we do have Chris Holling here also from Minscu Finance, who is the Minscu Finance Director as well, if there are any technical questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, that is the faculty at the seven state universities. IFO supports Minscu's efforts and the students' efforts to increase financial aid for working part-time students and therefore support both of these bills. Each fall when we set our legislative goals and I talk to faculty, almost inevitably one of the first things they come up with is that we need to be doing more for working part-time students. They say that these students show up in their classes, they're tired, they're trying to hold down a job, they're trying to hold down raising a family oftentimes, they're trying to go to school, and they're overwhelmed. It's affecting their performance academically, it's affecting their completion times, it affects whether they complete, period. And these students need your help. Governor Dayton has proposed a fantastic increase in student financial aid. However, we think that that aid could be better distributed. The Office of Higher Education proposal calls for a 28% increase in the cap for financial aid. I want you to know that not one penny of that reaches a state university student. Only a few community or two-year students get any assistance under that, raising that cap, and those are only in the very high-cost programs. At some of our high-cost programs. Raising the cap by itself costs about $70 million over the biennium. And it all goes to the high-cost, the students attending high-cost schools, the University of Minnesota, and the private schools. And we think there could be a much fairer distribution of this money, and one way would be to increase the cap by somewhat less than 28% and put some of that money into helping these part-time students. It'll reach more students, it'll reach the neediest students, and we would really recommend that you do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now what I'd like to do is call Ms. Fergus back to the table, and I'm going to just hand out the proposed discussion for amendment thing that I have to put forward, and let Ms. Fergus just talk about the various options. And then my plan is to just then have Director Pogemiller just say a few words about the governor's the governor's proposal, because that's different than what I'm proposing or what they're proposing. And again, we aren't going to have the discussion today because it is much fuller. I just want to have it before you to think about. Ms. Fergus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What you have before you in terms of the handouts that were presented, just for clarification, you have three proposals that were handed out to you. The one with the orange bar is the governor's recommendation. When we prepare a spending simulation for a state grant proposal, we actually look at how that spending changes by income and by sector.
because we simulate spending on a per student basis. In addition, you should have a packet that has a line chart as well as a pink bar. And I believe this is your amendment, Senator Bonnock. Did that one get handed out as well?
Ms. Fergus?
We have that.
Yeah, we have that, yes.
So okay. We have the last one.
Yeah. But I'm not orange. Seeing the one that Ms. Fergus is talking about.
The previous
about,
one we didn't.
With the orange.
They might be sitting on a chair back here.
But we should have them.
Okay.
We have them.
And then the third spending simulation is simply a shorter one that looks like this, which would be the Senator Champion and Senator Eakinsville for the proration.
And then, Ms. Fergus, I asked my staff to just, in more layman's terms, prepare a spreadsheet that compares the A3 amendment and the Eakin Champion in terms of how many students served. And so, members, what the bill or the amendment that I put forward for discussion, it raises the cap. It doesn't go all the way. It raises it to 13,000, but it also helps the independent student by taking the share down from 86% to 50%. So we're picking up. So while we're not dealing with the part-time, we are understanding that within the part-time group, there are those independent students that are not getting equal access. And I would have liked to do independent students with children and without, but have been directed that the Pell is much more favorable to the independents with children than without, and so money can only be spread so far, so the amendment before you helps the independent students and raises the cap. Ms. Fergus.
Correct, Madam Chair. The issue at hand is essentially how the family income and assets are treated within the state grant program. What we do is when a student and family fills out the FAFSA, we take a look at what their income and assets are. If they are a $40,000 family, federal policy dictates what their contribution should be. It is that contribution that determines their federal Pell Grant amount, and then we utilize that contribution in the state grant formula. For a $40,000 family, that assessment rate may be 10 to 15% of their income, so $4,000 to $6,000 per year. That assessment does not vary based on how many credits they take. It is simply the assessment of their current income and assets. It is in the student's decision to determine how many credits they take within that year. In the Minnesota State Grant formula, we further reduce that contribution. If they are a parent of a dependent student, we only utilize 96% of the contribution. If they are an independent student with children, we only use 86% of the contribution. And if they're an independent student without children, we only use 68% of that contribution. And the rationale for that is because within federal policy, that income and asset assessment provides for an income protection allowance based on how many workers you have in your household and whether you are primarily the student or the employee. So if you are working and your spouse is going to college, their income is protected because they are working. However, if you are a student who is going to college, even though you may work, federal policy does not protect a great share of your income. And that is why your assessment is larger under federal policy. And we attempt to fix that within the state grant program. In terms of part-time students in the state grant, that assessment, that $4,000 to $6,000 assessment, does not change by number of credits, because we assume that over time, part-time students have more time to earn income. So we try to keep that assessment rate flat, so that if a student takes 4 years and is asked to contribute 10% of their income, they essentially contribute the same 10% that a student taking 8 years would be, who has 8 years of income to consider. It is that flat assessment rate that provides the equity within the program. If we were to change the program in order to prorate, as the Champion and Eakin bills do, you would be asking us to reduce the assessment simply because the student is enrolled part-time, even though they have a longer time period to earn income. At which point, over the 120 credit period, because all students are eligible for 120 credits of state grant, regardless of whether they are part-time or full-time, over the 120 credit period, full-time students would be assessed at 10% rate, and part-time students would have a proportionally lower assessment rate if we were to prorate it. And I apologize because I bet that is not layman's terms at all.
But I guess what the bottom line is that people should look at, if you look at Mr. Kornecki's chart, it says that you would pick up, with for $17 million, you would pick up 9,941 students, so almost 10,000 students for $17 million, and increase 1,600 per student served. With the change that I proposed, it costs more, almost double, 40, and you pick up 15,000 students, 15,100, and you increase to 1,743. And then if you compare that to what the governor recommended, his recommendation for $40 million only picked up 4,100 students, but increased it to 1,929. And so what I was really trying to do was provide some middle ground to capture more students and give more students more dollars. But I would like to ask Director Pogemiller to join us. Yes. Senator Champion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Commissioner Pogemiller is approaching the podium, but as I look at your amendment, it appears to provide more resources, for lack of a better word, for four-year programs and four-year institutions. Is that right or wrong? Or am I reading that accurately?
It does
enough?
Two things. Mm-hmm. It by increasing the cap, it gives students who choose to go to the more expensive schools more of them access and
more money as well, Madam Chair.
Well, more of them too. We're picking up an additional. From the governor's recommendation, I'm picking up from 4,000 to 15,000 students. So I'm picking up 11,000 more students. So more students. And it does also, that has to do with the way we're treating the independent students as well.
One follow-up question, Madam Chair.
I have increased the amount of students going to the two-year schools, too. Minsky gets and it goes from.
But it looks like the maximum
goes
tuition.
Up 10,000 students. Serving Chair, additional 10,000 students, which is how many you served additionally.
Madam Chair, it appears from your proposal that the private schools even are receiving more of the benefit as opposed to the demographic that your. That your Minsky school attracts because you're enlarging the number of eligible folks at a private school and increasing that dollar amount. Because if you look at what I believe to be 1.7, it says the year of the biennium is 13,000 for students in four-year programs. While simultaneously, when you look at line 1.8, there's that maximum of 5,865. And I'm not sure if there is an increased a pool for the two-year institution under your
Senator Champion,
proposal.
And we really will explore this in more detail, but just in summary to your point, if you look at your total with $17 million, you're giving it to 9,900 more students. Do you see that at the bottom on my chart?
I don't. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I don't have your chart. So
would somebody please
I'm taking this based on.
That's done.
On the.
Good.
Oral analysis.
Okay, so go down to the bottom where I have the Eakin Champion proposal. You've got $17 million to serve 9,941 students. Okay.
This is not helpful. Oh, I see it.
Now, if you go to the top line of the A3 amendment. Of the money I'm proposing, $19 million of it is serving 10,000 more students. So I actually am picking up the same amount of students from Minsky that your proposal does. I'm adding some other things to it as well, but I am picking up the same amount of students that your proposal does.
Madam Chair, I see that on your spreadsheet, but I haven't had the opportunity to
I understand.
Do our own analysis
yep. Thank
of
you.
This notion.
Director Pogemiller, so we're going to give you like a few minutes to just tell us why the governor
feels the way he feels. And then, members, what I'd like to do is we have the room till 6, and two of the bills have out-of-town folks here for. So I'd like to get through those two bills. Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to visit. And this will be a continuing conversation. I've tried to meet with many of the members, and well, those of you who haven't, I will be there eventually. Context. Post-secondary education is about a $7 billion operation in Minnesota. You're talking about allocating $240 million. So I think you need to start out by thinking about what can you affect with that level of investment. And what you can affect is helping fundamentally affect the debt levels for some students and their ability to get into the institution of their choice is what the governor's argument is. He views the entire state grant discussion as a starting point this year, and more money has to be added, probably about $400 million to do this right, to get it properly calibrated. And so with that in mind, the first thing to understand is Pell and state grant are complementary. They are not supplemental. They are built on two different policies. Pell is built on an entitlement policy of you get so much money up to a certain point, up to $5,500, now gone up $85. The state grant, which was developed 30-some years ago by a Democratic-controlled legislature and a Democratic governor, is meant to be complementary to allow students to get into the institution that they believe best fits their aspirations. And so you need to be careful. You cannot make up totally for what Pell doesn't do. You don't have enough money. So in that context, and knowing that from the governor's perspective, this is viewed as an attempt to start to build back to that $400 million, which would get you where you want to be for all of these students, you have to make some choices. The first thing I want to make clear is that if you assume that we are measuring ability to pay on a one-year snapshot, then the state grant program, as currently designed, is absolutely equitable vertically and horizontally, is how they talk about it. So it is simply not true that the state grant program discriminates based on part-timeness. That is simply not factually true. If you introduce a preference for part-time students, I think we would argue that's probably not the direction you want to go. So across income and level of credits, the current state grant design is vertically and horizontally equitable. In fact, it actually smooths out the problem of the Pell program, which is called a credit banding problem. Our state grant program fixes that. The issue, we think, is better understood as independent students, not part-time versus full-time. It is absolutely true, and as you listen closely to the description of some of the types of students, it is absolutely true that if you are an independent student without family support, that the federal needs analysis does not buy down enough. The state already buys it down, and you should buy it down more. Absolutely. And that is less expensive than putting money into every part-time student. So on two policy bases, we think in terms of targeting the money, you should deal with independent students. And secondly, not part-time, full-time, because we would argue, the office, the professionals in the office would argue, you should not give a preference to part-time students. And then finally, the governor considered all of these items. And I'll use the $400 million figure. If you had $400 million, you would fix the cap. You would take the living and miscellaneous expense from $7,000 to probably $12,000, and you would buy down the federal needs analysis further for independent students. You would do all of those things. But we only have $80 million, unless you're going to put more money in. And we appreciate, by the way, the governor appreciates the Senate target of being 262, the same as his target. The first thing in the governor's judgment is to fix the cap and then add as much as you can to living in miscellaneous expense. Why fix the cap first? Because the only group of students that has not had their tuition increases bought out by the state grant are the University of Minnesota students and the nonprofit college students. Every MNSTU student has had their tuition increases bought off if they're a grant student. Only at the University of Minnesota, since 2008, and the nonprofit colleges, have tuition increases not been bought off by the state grant. So those students are all paying an implicit amount more than kind of the deal under the state grant design. And the deal was 46%. Those students are paying a lot more than that. Matter of fact, even MNSCU students who are under the cap are paying closer to 50%. So what we're suggesting and what the governor decided was get the system calibrated correctly first so that the deal we're making with a student in terms of shared responsibility reflects real prices that they face. And so that's what the governor's proposal is. Trust me, if he had more money, he would move LME up. And if you choose to put in more money, we would suggest you do that. And we would also suggest that you buy down the federal needs analysis for independent students. Madam Chair, let me leave it at that.
Very good. So, Senator Eakin.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to address the issue that the bill really, it's not even addressing the issue of the part-timeness so much as it is the working part-time mm-hmm. students. Because it doesn't go to all part-time students. This is just for those who are working part-time students, and they are actually being treated differently from part-time students who are not working. This is simply asking that they be treated the same.
I think Ms. Fergus is shaking her head. Ms. Fergus? So,
because right now the part-time students who are not working, they are prorated.
Ms. Fergus, can you want to?
But not those who are working, that make enough money to where.
I think she's not sure about that.
Madam Chair and Senator Egan, I just want to clarify that pretty much the majority of students work. This is not a question of those students who work and those students who don't. Pretty much every student you ask has a job, whether it's a summer job or a job while enrolled. All students work. It's just that some students do not meet the minimum threshold for an assessment to be asked of them. So if they're an independent student with no children, they are allowed up to $11,000 worth of income each year. If they are an independent student with children, we allow them $22,000 of income each year. If they are a parent of a dependent student, we also allow them $22,000 of income each year. Assessments only start above that point. So even if they're working a part-time job, their income would have to exceed those minimum thresholds for a contribution to be required. Senator Egan is correct in that this bill does only affect those students who exceed that threshold. If the students are under that threshold, their AFR is zero, and you can't really reduce zero.
Okay, very good. So, members, we are going to address the performance funding on Thursday, and then we're going to come back at this on Monday. We're going to have a special time to review the overall bill and have this discussion on
Madam Chair, I have one question, maybe of the testifier, because I heard Mr. Pogermiller make a statement saying that the state grants program as it sits right now is equitable. And so to the expert here, I want to know, because I think I heard her say that she does a lot of analysis around the state grant program, and I want to know if you share that conclusion that is equitable as it sits right now.
Madam Chair and Senator Chaffetz, if we are defining equity as net in that we require the same contribution of all students, then yes, it is equitable. We assess their incomes at the same rate, regardless of whether they are part-time or full-time.
And if there's another way that you're looking at it, is there another way to look at it where it's not seen as equitable?
Well, I believe, Madam Chair and Senator Chaffetz, your argument is that it should be equitable on a per-credit basis. We do not award state grants on a per-credit basis, but rather on a term and annualized basis. And that is where we have our equity defined, is on the longer-term perspective.
Thank you. You're a good lawyer, too.
nail that thing. Okay, very good. Thank you, members. Yes, Senator Eakin.
If I could make one more point, thank you, Madam Chair, on the issue of having more years to pay, as you had stated earlier, I think it is important to note the four-year cap again, or the cap on eight semesters, which would be the equivalent of 4 years. So they can only qualify for that grant for that period of time. And that, to me, is a great incentive to take as many credits as you possibly can so that you can get the grant during that period of time before it runs out. So I think there is an incentive for students to go full-time, and even if they are getting prorated to the same level of grant aid per credit as full-time students. And as far as the talking about students who are not working as opposed to those that are, I agree that there's a number that are working part-time that obviously do get some assistance, but those who are not working are being prorated it'd be the same per credit as full-time students would be, those that are going part-time. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Egan, it's if they're under the minimum threshold. If they earn less than $11,000 for independent students with children or $22,000.
Right, and Madam Chair, that would include students that are not working.
Right. Very good. Thank you. Well, thank you for bringing it forward. Director Pogemiller?
Oh, Madam Chair and Director Pogemiller, we just wanted to clarify that the four-year limit is a credit limit, meaning that it's 4 years or eight semesters times 15 credits. So all students qualify for 120 credits of state grant aid, regardless of whether they take those 3 credits at a time or 15 credits at a time.
So, Ms. Fergus, I could be using it for 10 years.
They can, Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. That is different understanding. Thank you. So, again, members, we will make sure to schedule this time. I don't want to be held to exactly when we're going to do it, and we'll give you plenty of notice. Okay. Thank you very much. So now, Senator Weber. So we're just going to lay this over, all the material before you. Thank you, Senator Champion, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Weber has an author's amendment.
That is correct. Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is your first committee jurisdiction?
This is the first time I have been in front of your committee.
Okay,
yes,
very good. And it's the first time the bill's been heard.
The first time the bill's been heard,
very
yes.
Very good. I guess the amendment is actually in members' packets.
If I might mention, Madam Chair, this amendment was the wording on this amendment was approached to me by Minsky representatives this morning, and I was in agreement with it, and so that's why it is being offered at this point in time.
Okay, so Senator Torres-Ray offers the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wants. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate File 1363 as amended.
Thank you. I'm pleased, Madam Chair and members of the committee, to present to you today Senate File number 1363. In 2011, there was a pilot program that was begun whereby reserves of Minsky were taken and distributed out and deposited in communities where Minsky operations were. For example, I have a testifier with me today from Worthington, and this was for a two-year period. And the purpose of that was to have these funds into the communities where the colleges were located to help them, the banking, qualified banks, were, of course, they were only deposited in qualified banks, and that they were then allowed to use those reserves to help in their terms of their loan portfolio in the community. And that was a two-year project. It ended at the end of 2012, and those funds have since been returned. It was a successful project, but due to the sunsetting, it does no longer exist, and this legislation would allow it to continue on. And the amendment, the Senate file as amended, there were a couple of minor changes. The other thing that it did is rather than have a two-year period, no more than a two-year period, it is extending it up to a five-year period that Minsky can negotiate with the local financial institutions in order to deposit funds. And then as far as a reporting process, rather than every other year, every 4 years. And I have with me today Mr. Jerry Koppel, Executive Vice President of First State Bank in Worthington, and he would like to just comment briefly about the effect that this project had within his bank and in his community. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Weber mentioned, my name is Jerry Koppel. I'm Executive Vice President in charge of lending for First State Bank Southwest in Worthington, Minnesota. We are a $200 million financial institution serving Worthington and approximately a 30-40-mile radius surrounding Worthington. We also, in Worthington, are home to the campus of the Minnesota West Community and Technical College, Worthington campus, and we have enjoyed that relationship for many, many years. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File Number 1363, which is the Minskew Reserve Project, and how it impacted and benefited our community in terms of our bank and the community in being able to take the deposit from Minskew and use it within our community for productive purposes. Just a little bit of history about the project that we participated in January 2nd of 2011. We were part of the pilot project, and it began with the transfer of $2.1 million of deposit funds to our bank at First State Bank Southwest. That program did end on December 31st of 2012 when the money was returned to the Minnesota West College and Technical College. We believe that the pilot program was very successful because in the banking business, as you all know, we're involved in basically taking in deposits within our communities from customers and turning around and lending them out within our community. During that time, we were able to put that money back to work within our community, to the tune of 177 loans for a total of $3.6 million of new loans during that two-year period. Just to drill down a little bit further, a couple of examples of some lending activity using those funds for useful purposes, which generated jobs, created tax revenue, and giving businesses the ability to give back to their community. The funds were utilized to start up an adult daycare facility, which began operations in September of last year. The facility serves 11 clients and has created two full-time and one part-time job, and is intended to grow even more beyond that. Another example is a local pharmacist who we have enjoyed a relationship for many years, has been able to expand his pharmacy and being able to support and serve more of community service. So those are just two examples of how we were able to put this money back to work within our community, benefiting our local community, and in turn benefiting the Minskew, the college within our town. In addition to that, just to conclude my comments, Madam Chair, we as a bank, one of our missions or core values is to become involved in the community, and I'd also serve as a board member for the college foundation. And I'm happy to report that our bank and the employees of our bank, not only with the deposit from the Minskew system, put $125,000 of contributions back into our community, of which the Minnesota West Community College and Technical College benefited from that. So I wanted to voice my support today in terms of continuing or extending the reserve project. It's been very beneficial for us.
Senator Weber, Mr. Koppel, are you aware that other community institutions are also anxious to participate in this? Have you communicated this on a widespread basis? Do you know, Senator Weber or Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, as I understand, when the project was originally started, there were requests for proposals. There was a request for proposals, and thereby institutions could submit, possibility of being the depository for those funds and offer the rates and this type of thing. And so it is available. There are certain requirements. You know, institutions have to meet certain requirements in order to be considered due to the safety, preserving the safety of state funds and that type of thing. So it is open and available to any qualified bank.
Senator Weber, I'm concerned on the amendment line 1.5 that we move from reporting of every other year and insert every 4 years. It seems to me that it would be – I personally would rather see reporting each biennium versus a four-year time because it seems to me we control our money on a biennial basis, and if there were ever a problem to wait for a four-year time horizon, but it looks like Ms. King has a response for that.
I was going to mention, Madam Chair, that Laura King, Vice Chancellor of Minsku, is here to also answer any questions, and I'll turn it over to her at this point.
Thank you, Senator. Good afternoon, Senator Bonoff. The way we looked at this bill, you'll notice in on line 110 and again on line 2-4, there are reports to MMB every 2 years, as the way the bill is drafted. Mm-hmm. The amendment that we worked with the author on to change line 219 really had to do with the full program evaluation report that we did at the end of the pilot, because we now share the conclusion that this is worth doing if we do it well, and so it doesn't need the full pilot evaluation report that the original author, when this was put in law 4 years ago, constructed. So we'd still have MMB reporting, but we do a full program report every 4 years is what this would contemplate.
Ms. King, could you again direct me to the MMB part? What line?
Certainly. On line 111, starting with 111, in and around 111, it provides mm-hmm. for us communicating with MMB as to what participation we contemplate, which schools, how much money, et cetera. And then you'll see again on page 2.4, by December 1 of every other year, we again are in communication with MMB about program participation. So there's regular reporting, but the line 219 calls for a full evaluation every 4 years.
Okay, well, we can consider it. Thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question, subdivision 4 talks about an independent evaluation being made. For the pilot, was there such an independent report that was done? And maybe
Madam
just
Chair,
a quick summary about...
Ms. King.
Certainly, Senator Klassen. There was a full evaluation done, and as you see in the language, which is a complete repeat from the earlier version, there was an evaluation prepared by my office, submitted to Senator Bonoff, and there was an evaluation prepared by the Office of Management and Budget, submitted to a whole host of ranking members. So that work was done, and what that work found was generally this program, if it's designed right, has some virtue. And so we're comfortable with the Senator's bill continuing it on that basis.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you. As I understand it, then for a period of time, the money is basically lent to a local bank, correct? When that money is repaid, is it with interest or is it just principal? And if there's an interest, is it a dedicated interest or is it up to the market?
Maybe just a little background, if I might, Senator Klassen. The money that's contemplated being accessed for this program are the funds that we hold in our college and university reserve accounts that are currently deposited with the state treasury where they earn interest, which is assigned to us. And we use it for our college and university budgets. So there is interest earning that goes on right now with our deposits. What this program enabled us to do was take the money out of the state depository accounts and put it into local accounts under a negotiated arrangement that absolutely provided for interest or other remuneration, depending upon the individual negotiations. But the idea is that we would earn more interest in the community bank than we're earning in the state depository. That was the threshold test. And we found that to be the case. Now, we entered into this right as the market declined, so it was sort of a close call, but we had enough positive experience to suggest it would be worth continuing.
Madam Chair, is that a fixed interest rate that's negotiated prior to the transfer of funds?
It's a competitive process, Madam Chair. We bid competitively for that deposit, just as we would any other deposit. It happened to be a certificate of deposit for a two-year period, which, based on the time value of money, would be an interest rate that would be commensurate with that period of time. So it would be earning an interest rate that is competitive with market conditions.
Thank you.
Senator Bonner. Senator Bonner.
Senator Sharon.
Did I understand that is there a length of time in which the relationship is developed with the community bank, and so that the opportunity to bid for these dollars is every 2 years for another community bank in Worthington, for example?
As the legislation is written right now, and with the proposed amendment that was requested by Minskew, it actually could be negotiated for up to a five-year period in order that they could take advantage of better rates, maybe offered for a longer-term deposit and that type of thing. And so that was at the request of Minskew. But there is no two-year requirement at this point in terms of that it has to be renegotiated every 2 years. It's my understanding that the two-year that was mentioned was reporting as to how much of the funds were being deposited in this manner.
And Senator Sharon, so...
But the point would be that if it's not 2 years, it's at some point 5 years, there would be a process in which other banks in a community that have more than one community bank have an opportunity to get the benefit of this program. And the decision making is a bidding process with the state, not the state is the one that makes the decision.
That is correct.
Not a local community or a Minskew decision.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is correct.
And Senator Weber, would you be open to between now and the time we put this bill together, perhaps working on some language whereby this committee would get reporting? And we don't need, it sounds like, in deference to Ms. King's point, we don't need a big project evaluation report, but I think we would like to have visibility of where the money is and how it's doing.
Madam Chair, I believe that's entirely possible. And also, I do want to make one correction there. Earlier, Senator Sharon, when you mentioned about the state decision, it's actually those decisions are made by Minskew as far as being responsible for their funds that are part of the state treasury.
It is, Senator Bonner, but it's at the state level. It's not like South Central Tech isn't making the decision or Southwest State. It's made at the board level.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, you'll see in the bill, Subdivision 2, Line 116, universities apply to the Board of Trustees. And the Board of Trustees, on a recommendation from my office, would be the decision maker.
Okay. Thank you.
Pretty interesting, innovative approach.
Is there a particular bank that's South Central that you'd like us to make sure?
No, I just know that when I was on local government that this issue was always a fight between the banks.
Yes, it is. Yes.
And that it's especially important that it is a fair process.
We were, just as a sidebar, Senator Bonhoff, we were frankly surprised. We only had three relationships that perfected in this current pilot. We had eight schools interested, but at the end of the day, when it got time to a real deal, we only had three banks. Not nearly the participation we expected. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it could have been a market timing issue. We might have a much different result this next time around. But it wasn't the widespread success, I think, that was expected at the time.
Well, thank you very much for bringing forward this innovative program, and we appreciate it. So we'll lay this over for possible inclusion. Senator Torres-Ray?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. And Senator Weber, I really appreciate that you did this, and I am actually surprised with the idea of having this moving forward with concepts that are typically presented by our political philosophies as market-based, the free market, whether or not we embrace those concepts. And I am so pleased to know that you are moving forward an idea that puts into question some of those concepts that we freely toss around and say, well, let the free market take care of this. Well, sometimes we have to be proactive to say we need to support our communities and need to look for approaches that may be different, that will have a different approach. And this one is, in my view, I support these kind of ideas. And it's a control, kind of approach. You want to offer a pilot, see how it works. But we do need to experiment with this outside of these boxes that many times we kind of proclaim to be the boxes that we're part of in terms of free markets and competitive markets. This is a competitive idea. You're looking for a competitive market, a model that will be competitive, but it's outside of the box of the free market. It's community-based. And so I just wanted to make that comment because I do think that the economic future demands in this country demands that we take approaches that sometimes are outside of those boxes that we have been assigned to kind of pursue. So thank you for doing that.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, thank you. And I think it's also important to remember that our MUNSCU operations are vital and important neighbors to our local communities. And if there's a way that we can help our local communities prosper, it makes our institutions better places for our students as well.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Kent. Time. Yes, we're going to just stay till your bill's done.
Thank you.
I just said we're going to lay it over. And we're going to do one of her bills right now, and then we're going to do the other one Thursday. Senator Kent.
Thank you, everybody, Madam Chair, and committee members for your patience. I am here today to introduce Senate File 1345, and I'd like to start by moving an author's delete all amendment, the A1 amendment. It just incorporates a few more partners and updates it, but keeps everything largely, from an idea standpoint, the same. I believe this is a very exciting opportunity in our pursuit of preparing our students and future workforce because it takes technologies and tools and programs that the state already has, and it leverages and applies them to some of our most critical education and workforce development issues, college readiness, college success, and the skills gap. This is a really rich application because it already operates in a somewhat limited form, and then the bill provides for a highly integrated partnership among stakeholders. So bear with me as I describe a very powerful tool for Minnesota students, workers, and employers. Historically, test scores and GPAs have always been the most efficient and therefore most prevalent measures for higher ed purposes. But we all recognize the limitations of these metrics in preparing and translating into academic and professional success. So a web-based proficiency portfolio is the next generation, a tool for students and workers to demonstrate their real skills and experiences to admissions and employment professionals. In the past year, there have been several recommendations for new applications of digital portfolios. This was highlighted in a recent Star Tribune editorial, which has been included in your packet. The proficiency portfolio approach will make it possible for students to be judged on a portfolio of their best academic work as well as available internship or work products, graduates to share their judged proficiency portfolios with prospective employers, and to add to their portfolios in the future to demonstrate their lifelong learning and professional development, and colleges to tailor their programs to students seeking proficiency certification at any age or station in life or to employer-specific needs. The Itasca Group and higher ed leaders have already begun working to move this approach forward in Minnesota. The American Association of Colleges and Universities has already enlisted 10 Minnesota colleges, public and private, to work with business to help design a system that meets the needs of employers. This legislation will leverage existing state assets to provide the statewide technology infrastructure to make it work. In addition, the Minnesota Career and College Readiness Collaborative, which includes MNSCU, the U, the Department of Education, and the Minnesota Learning Commons, has called for a Minnesota statewide digital portfolio system to support the transition from K-12 to college. It recommends a statewide web-based system for all students and individuals to access their individual learning plans, or ILPs, at all stages of their lives, in furtherance of the 9-to-14 realignment strategies promoted by the leaders at MNSCU, the Department of Education, and OHE. This initiative connects across the key jurisdiction, from K-12 to higher ed to the workforce, and includes multiple stakeholders. So rather than create a new bureaucracy, we've identified the Minnesota Learning Commons, an existing interagency collaborative and joint powers entity, as an appropriate vehicle for bringing all these stakeholders to the table, OHE, MDE, MNSCU, the U, and DEED, and for implementing a solution. And the legislation requires consultation with business groups, labor, private colleges, and others to ensure broad input. To promote efficiencies and reduce costs, the bill would use and enhance existing state assets, tools, and services to create an academic and career success infrastructure. In Minnesota, as in so many cases, we're fortunately way ahead of the curve, as we already have the award-winning eFolio Minnesota and the award-winning GPS Life Plan. eFolio Minnesota is an online portfolio system developed in partnership with MNSCU and the U for higher ed, and it's received an award by the Council on State Governments for technology innovation. GPS Life Plan, which serves a dozen Minnesota colleges and military veterans, helps students set goals and design plans that will lead them to college or career success. It also provides a high school and workforce version of the program. In addition, the Learning Commons can incorporate other applications and programs, such as the U's Ramp Up to Readiness, to provide a continuum of tools for K-12, higher ed, and the workforce. Because of these assets and this experience, Minnesota doesn't need to spend vast amount of funds and reinvent the wheel. This smart and cost-effective strategy leverages and extends our existing assets to meet these broader goals and needs. Collaborate and share rather than create multiple programs, systems, and applications for each agency. And because of the scalability of technology, we can provide these tools and programs to all students and job seekers, public and private, in every corner of the state, efficiently and effectively. To help provide some detail and real-world examples from the college counselor's perspective, I'd like to introduce Michelle Jersak, counselor and GPS Life Plan Outreach Coordinator for Century College, who will provide a brief presentation illustrating GPS Life Plan and eFolio Minnesota. Thanks.
Before we do that, Senator Kent, we're kind of struggling up here because we didn't see the delete all ahead of time.
Sorry.
And so we weren't able to get a fiscal note, and we're kind of pretty late in this process.
Do we have has the fiscal note been distributed? Sorry.
But do you have a fiscal note for the delete all?
I don't think it changed substantially, as I understand it.
We have Madam to delete. You can do
Madam Chair, I'd have to look at the language.
Okay, I apologize. This all kind of came together.
The fiscal note was done to the bill as introduced.
Okay. Well, as I said, and I don't know, Eric, if you can. It really hasn't changed meaningfully. And considering that the original fiscal note was $38,000 a year, it's still very low out of pocket.
Senator Kent, well, there's some concern because I'm hearing millions and you're talking thousands. So.
Okay.
There's an appropriation apparently that was projected for. $3.5 million.
Is that in there? I'm sorry. That's right. That was a two-year appropriation. Yes.
So really, I just want to be clear what we're here. So you're here to show us something, which is great, but you're also here requesting $3.5 million.
Yes. I apologize. Lots of things flying on this
one. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
Senator Sharon.
And the $3.5 million is specifically from higher ed. It's not
deed and K-12 and higher. It's not a shared cost.
And it's a little bit different in our version because, as we understand it, that this is moving in the House, but the House is funding it in the Department of it's through its E-12 division.
Right. That is correct.
So, you know, Senator Kent, they have a lot more money than we do.
Yes, I've heard. And this is one of those, Madam Chair, that does bridge all these different jurisdictions. You know, as we keep hearing, there are a number of these.
And, Senator Kent, I think, I have had a chance to meet with your folks and have heard about it and think it's good, but I'm just saying in terms of jurisdictional, we're guarding our money pretty close in here.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. Okay, good. So do we want to go ahead and see the presentation? Is it a – because we are very late. How long is the – because we
– I practice at 5 minutes.
Okay. Five, you promise.
If I can reach, that's okay.
Okay.
So thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Dursak, and I'm a faculty member and a member of the Minnesota State College's Faculty Association at Century College. And I will do even an abbreviated one. So GPS LifePlan has helped learners with all these aspects of their life, career, education, finance, leadership, and personal. It's great going last because you got to hear about all the struggles our students have. We initially created this tool at Century College to help students with those struggles and to connect them with resources that they need. And GPS is goals plus plans equals success. As you heard Senator Kent mention, we do have college versions, and we have versions for military. And we also did the workforce and the secondary, and we've worked with populations in all these areas. There's advisory groups for all. There actually is closer to 22 institutions or organizations within MinSCU who uses it at the customized level. And with the traffic, secondary is the second one in the top 10, includes a wide geographic area as well as military. And this map is just to demonstrate, even though not all colleges have customized site, that the vast majority of colleges in the MinSCU system have had some sort of level of involvement, whether it's training or showing interest in the GPS life plan with eFolio. Your handout that you had on the backside, it shows all the connection to resources, their interactivities. They tend to be openresources.gov, .org, .edu, occasionally .com, to help students connect with high interactive multimedia resources to help them in these areas of their life. Many colleges, I think it was estimated about 10, are using it for a course called First Year Experience or College Success Courses. These are some of the areas that they're using. It's estimated that it's saving students about $65,000, $85,000 on textbook costs because many of these schools are using this in place of their textbooks. This is just to give you an example of some of the material in there, career modules, helping connect with interests, helping students understand planning, helping them understand terminology and academic success, financing their education, creating a budget, connecting to campuses. Here's just an example of eFolio and what it will look like when students put that together and they organize it in a portfolio. And this can be password protected as well as shaped and polished to showcase themselves. And so students will often put in images to inspire them, pictures of their family, activities they've done, areas that represent their life goals, their career goals, and their education. It's multimedia. This is, if it was live, a video, as well as students love putting their own personal artwork in there. It inspires them. It can track competencies. And we've been working with secondary for last year, so this is just some snapshots that are private secondary, but their personal information is taken out. It helps them organize all their information for their career search, where they're planning and going. Again, students love putting images up because it inspires them. They can track and put in their certificates they've had. And you have this on your handout, a quote from teachers that it motivates students. This particular student who is from the Gap School used it for a scholarship, and the scholarship organization said that they looked at their her eFolio. They're very impressed, and she did get the scholarship partially based on that. We have worked with special education. We work with students who had autism, students in Stillwater, highly artistic, and here's some examples of putting their own personal work. It's just amazing to see these students open up and glow. It really does level that playing field, this multimedia approach. And again, you have on your handout some quotes from students. And as was mentioned, we have our workforce version and military links to both college and workforce. And on there, there's a step-by-step job seeker planner that walks a user through helping them organize their thoughts and information. And then it creates a report that helps them put their information together to meet with a counselor, but also action plans that connect either workforce version or the military version to help them out. Was that five?
That was great.
And so, Madam Chair, I just, when I started hearing about this, you know, this is something that already exists, the state already owns in certain capacities. As with everything, you know, things end up in the silos, and when we can broaden them out and just put them to work for us, there's just such a great opportunity. And when we talk about the secondary to post-secondary alignment and doing all this preparation for workforce, this just is so in the direction that we're headed. So it seems like a great
opportunity. And I see John Eichten from OET or Minute here. Does Minute have a comment? Or see any potential use and desire to fund? Minute could come forward and say, oh, we'll just use it, and so you don't need any money from higher ed.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is John Eichten. I'm legislative liaison for Minute Services.
My former legislative assistant.
And former legislative assistant to the chair, whatever that gets me here today. You know, this is the we have not been contacted regarding this bill. We'd be happy to look into it further. I think we're quite supportive of generally technology tools being used to coordinate the work between agencies, institutions, and help our students be better prepared to compete in a global workforce. But I would hesitate to comment at this time until we could look into it further.
Very good. And I think the thing that I like about it is you're giving a student an e-portfolio that when they graduate from college, hopefully they really can present as they go forward into the workforce. So while we may not have the resources sitting here, we do applaud the effort and would like to help you find some way to have the germ of the idea move from the MinSCU platform to this integrated approach. So thank you.
Great.
Yes.
Madam Chair, just to mention, at Century College alone, we do have quite a few examples of students using it for employment and getting jobs.
Great. Senator Klassen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My mind is kind of racing here because this has a lot of the components of Naviance.
Very familiar with Naviance.
Yeah, it sure would be nice to, you know, connect to the secondary because it has many of the same components about career planning, planning your high school career goals, identifying the courses you're going to take. It does a lot of self-assessments. It's a connection to the parents. Any thought about, you know, somehow, because we have so many schools using Naviance right now, do you see this moving down into the secondary? It makes a lot of sense to me that something is a continuation between secondary and post-secondary. And right now it looks like we've got two systems going on.
Yes, Senator Klassen, in our work with secondary, we've worked with Stillwater and some other schools, Irondale, who also use Naviance. The one thing that they appreciate about this, we used it with special ed transitions, is the multimedia effect of it and the price tag.
And before we end this discussion, we haven't officially adopted your author's amendment, so I want to make sure that we have it before the committee laid over in the form that you want. So Kent moves the Senate file 1345. I'm sorry, it moves the A1.
A1 amendment.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. So now any closing comments, Senator Kent?
I appreciate everybody's time. I know this has been a very long and full afternoon that feels like about a week and a half.
Yes.
But I do think that this is so consistent with so many of the different issues that we've talked about in terms of bridging some of these things and helping students at all levels start envisioning their lives and their opportunities and taking active planning roles in it and bringing it to life and bringing it to admissions directors and employers.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for bringing it forward. So we'll lay Senate file 1345 as amended for possible inclusion laid on the table. Very good.
Thank you very much.
And now we will adjourn the committee until.
We can do Minnesota Common.
Oh. They're saying that 1344 might be 2 seconds with the same people here. Is that true or not? They're saying.
This is my testifier for this one, and she's not available on Thursday. But
how long will it take, Senator Kent? Because we do have the – I just want to be respectful. People do want to go to that Ranger party, but I'm sure it'll be late.
We can probably do this in about 4 minutes.
Okay. Yes. All right, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for your continued
1344.
Patience. 1344. This would create a pilot effort at 2 MNSCU institutions to test the effectiveness of a program of intensive guidance, mentoring, and job placement, all to address the concerns we've all talked about, that students enter our institutions of higher education, but then they lack the pathway and support to complete their education and embark on their chosen career, and then they end up dropping out. As we've discussed, as of 2010, only 48% of students enrolled at a four-year MNSCU institution graduated within 6 years. And what we know is that students end up dropping out for a variety of reasons, specifically from a 2011 Harvard study. Those include not being prepared for the academic rigors, an inability to cope with competing demands of study, jobs, and family, as we've been hearing all about this afternoon, and then, of course, cost, which we keep talking about. The same Harvard study found that a robust mentoring program can reduce the dropout rate and, by extension, improve the completion rate. And furthermore, it connects students with jobs. This bill would create and test the effectiveness of such a program at MNSCU that would address these issues with targeted at-risk students. It would create 2 pilot programs of holistic mentoring for at-risk students, one at a MNSCU university and the other at a MNSCU college, that would provide a high level of course advising and guidance, personal financial counseling, and job placement. Specifically, we identify 5 objectives that would increase the likelihood that students will graduate. Help them identify programs of interest and connect them to applicable programs of study. Provide mentoring. Advise students on the funding of higher education. Connect students to employers while still a student. And then connect students with post-graduation employment opportunities. An additional part of this bill is an author's amendment, something else we've frequently spoken of, which is the need to assess effectiveness. And that is the A1 amendment that just inserts a follow-up measurement piece. This bill would require reporting on retention and graduation rates with an effort at quantifying related costs and return. And so to help provide some insight from the college counselor's perspective, I'd like to reintroduce Michelle Jerzak.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Go ahead.
Do you have the amendment?
I do. Do you not have it?
We don't. Oh, I apologize.
Oh, dear. Sorry. I thought I have 1 copy here. Actually, 2 copies here with me. And
I'm glad you have the A1 because I was noticing that there wasn't a reporting back.
Yes. And just very briefly, it's 3 sentences that I'll go over them quickly, and then you'll have a hard copy of it. But the board would report by November of 2015 on the results of the program to the chairs and ranking minority members. Report would identify for each pilot program its success in achieving program objectives that I listed, the 1 through 5, and the cost and cost effectiveness of meeting its objectives, and must include a recommendation on whether to make the program permanent and on appropriate cost effective program components.
Well, Senator Kent, even though it's late and you're last, this might be one of the more important bills that we've heard this session, because I think we all intuitively believe that if students have mentors, that obstacles can be moved out of the way.
Yep.
And they can be successful.
Yep, absolutely.
Senator Sharon.
Yeah, Senator Kent, I think this is absolutely the right approach that our higher ed institutions ought to be taking. And I'm going to vote for your bill. You know, we'll probably talk about what we can do with funding. But some time ago, under another president at Minnesota State Mankato, he instituted within his budget this proposal, including a dormitory, in living in situations, mentorings on the floor. Students chose to be in that dorm because it integrated this component to it within their budget.
Yep.
And I just want you to know that I think that we ought to be incentivizing this kind of activity in our higher ed institutions as a part of our performance measurements for the institution, and not and that their funding be based, their funding be yes. based on their accomplishing these objectives, rather than us attaching some money and asking them to apply for it. It should be within the appropriations that we send that this is what they do in order to achieve outcomes that we expect. So I don't think it should needs to be a pilot program. It should be done within the existing appropriation.
And we do have a fiscal note.
Without those.
That's not very much.
Yes,
yeah, that's fine. So, Ms. Weidman, could you just review the fiscal note? Do you have it? Oh, Senator Claussen.
Yeah, just one quick question. In the last 2-3 weeks, I've had conversations with 2 to 3 different groups of college counselors. They've been talking about layoffs. They've been talking about reduction in staff. Is this related? In other words, would this program not be necessary 5 years ago because we had the staff in place that was doing this work? Tough question, perhaps.
That is a tough question. The one thing I would say, and I think hopefully one of the best things that could come out of something like this is to quantify, and going back to what Senator Sharon was saying, not just this is what this costs this year, but trying to project if we spend this $100,000, we will save or realize, you know, this many millions of dollars of benefits over some amount of time. You know, I know it's difficult to evaluate things over the long term, but I think we all recognize intuitively that the costs of not doing something like this are ultimately probably a lot higher than trying to do it.
And Senator Claussen and Madam Chair, yes, actually, that was part of my testimony, is that in 1993, when I graduated, I went to a community college. I went to the University of Minnesota. I had a program like this, the Chicano Latino Center there. I graduated with just a few $100s worth of debt because of the high intensity of mentorship. And since then, as we all know, that there's been less investment in public higher ed, and so as a result, much of what's cut is student support services, counseling, and I think I was trying to calculate with our representative, I think we're at 50% of what I was of counseling staff across the state as what when I graduated from college from a community college. Drastically, it's been reduced. But also at the same time, the students' needs are going up. Just within our Century College, about 2008, we had around 37% Pell Grant recipient. Recently, I checked with our director. It's closer to, it's over 60%. And they're qualitatively different. Now we're seeing a lot more long-term generational poverty, which has a completely different, I mean, the mentoring is so key. In fact, I'm going to, for professional development, become a poverty coach and go to an institute this summer. And a huge part of that is the oral presentation versus print presentation, and then also the mentorship and the relationship building that's needed for our students at highest risk.
Thank you.
And Senator Kent, as I looked at the fiscal note, I'm inclined with Senator Sharon to believe that this is something we'd like Minsky to do. And so to do these two pilots, you know, I understand they've identified that it would cost a certain amount, but I think we believe it's mission critical and that they should absorb that cost. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, and we do need to move the A1.
I'll move the
for
A1.
Senator Sharon. Yes. Senator Kent moves the A1.
Yes,
very
sorry.
Good. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion is adopted. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm doing an exercise with E12 with respect to the multiple programs that are defined in policy for supporting students that I hope I can continue to do during the interim and bring back next year. But As I review, Senator Kent's proposal and your, Senator Sharon's and your feedback on this, I want to presume that there are a lot of policy, there's a lot of language in our books that actually say that we are to be doing this. I am assuming that. I haven't worked in higher ed. But I do think that there is a lot of value on putting together some kind of a review process to figure out how these things kind of come together. I was just shocked to see how much policy we have around parent involvement in E12. I mean, it's been defined in every chapter in one way or another. I presume that support to students to complete their, you know, their education in higher education, it's absolutely there. So there is a very important, I think, opportunity that you're opening, Senator Kent, to review really what we have and how it works and how, you know, connects to what you're trying to do here.
Very good. So let's move that Senate file 1344 as amended be laid over to for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thanks, everyone, for staying. We completed our